Ladies and gentlemen, the World Wide Web proudly presents... Recorded live in Chicagoland, USA. Snurd Fling Flangy.
Enough comedy jokes.
A new episode of the podcast, Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport. With your hosts, Luke Ski and Carrie Dalby.
My cat is afraid
of the vacuum cleaner.
The way it goes, vroom, 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 vroom.
Hi, this is Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport. I'm Luke.
And I'm Carrie.
No, you're not.
No, what?
You're Chris Mazzalusto of Power Salad, aren't you?
I am.
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay.
So this is not a regular full-fledged episode of Bad Rapport because Carrie is not with us and I didn't prepare any news of the stupid. So there.
It's only half-fledged and I'm the stupid.
Yes. So,
Oh, boy.
Although we do have a message from Carrie so that she could be part of this podcast, so let me pull up Google Voice, and we can hear it right now.
Hey, Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport. This is Carrie checking in from America's friendliest airport, Phoenix Sky Harbor. And, look, there's a law that prohibits smoking indoors. And there's a solar going off, as you can tell I'm calling from the ladies' room. I just got back from Casa Grande, the land of drive-through liquor stores and signs that say no firearms allowed on kids' places. And I'm heading off to the land of Lay's and pineapple and coconuts. So have an enjoyable Surf Just the What discussion, hopefully with fewer flushing toilets than we're having right now. And next time on Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport after this will be Luke and Carrie. Bye.
So that was Carrie checking in as they head further west to the island of Hawaii for their delayed honeymoon. As we set sail across the wide seas, we see Chris Mazzalusta and his musical nose.
Oh! Sorry, let me get my, okay. Got it.
All right. So, I have been promising for, you know, months and months since the announcement of Cirque du Soir that I was going to talk about it and talk about the weekend we had recording and stuff, but I kept intentionally delaying because I didn't want to give away the jokes on the album. So this is kind of a special side episode. If you haven't heard the album yet, I would...
What is the matter with you?
Yes, I think it would be for the best that you not listen to the episode because I would prefer you to hear the jokes as they were before you hear us talking about them. But... nonetheless, we are heading forth. Later on in the episode, probably at the very end, I'm going to tack on here a non-Cirque du Soir related discussion in which I have a quick sit-down with the wonderful voice of Kiki, and she and I discuss the finale of Lost. So, but for now, right here live in the wonderful Des Plaines, Illinois, Luke Ski Studio, we have Chris Mazzalusto of Power Salad.
Hello, Tile.
And we asked people to send us questions about Cirque du Soir. So why don't right here... first I'll play a song. I want to play the song, a song by the Arrogant Worms, because it ties into Canada, and it ties into the store we had to stop at on our way out of town. And because we like to put songs in these episodes. So,
songs are fun.
So we'll have a song, and then we'll edit in the half-hour, or whatever it was, Coffee Klatch interview with Cirque du Soir featuring all four members.
Oh, I remember that.
Yes, and we recorded that, and people asked questions, and we answered them, so you can get, questions answered by all four of us. And then we will play another song to be determined later. I thought of the songs I wanted to play before. Oh, no, I know what it was.
Oh.
I think we should play one of the live sketches that we did in our show.
We have performed, and there is proof.
Yes. Probably the one about a certain hotel room, or a certain variety of hotel rooms that can be gotten, I think.
Types of hotel rooms that happen when people are tired and traveling and looking for places to.
Yes. So then after that, we'll come back and it'll be you and me live again. So it'll be like magic. I'll just snap my fingers and we will teleport to that time in the thing right now.
Baby, I wanna tell you all my hopes and dreams and fears. But I'm watching television. Could you get me another beer? There's wrestling and pro football on. I hope you understand. I must watch it all, for I am a man, and a man has needs, and a man has desires. Eternal fires that burn, burn, burn. And a man, he bleeds, and a man, he perspires till the stains show on his shirt. Our anniversary, the birth of our son. It was beyond my control. My team was on a playoff run. Oh, baby, 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 you mean everything to me. But could you move your butt? You're blocking the TV. But a man has needs. Eternal fires that burn, burn, burn. And a man, he bleeds. And a man, he does tire. Gets sleepy and naps on the couch.
Oh, baby, oh, honey, oh, darling, oh, pudding. What are you doing with that suitcase? Leaving me? What do you mean we don't communicate? We're talking all the time. We're talking about who? Monster trucks. Yeah, that little Volkswagen ain't got no chance against the cow crusher. Come on, cow crusher! Crush that little Volkswagen! You're wrong. I hope she left me one of them wooden pops they tasted.
For a man has needs, and a man has desires.
The Cirque du Soleil coffee clatch thing. So, okay, somebody here. What was your name? I'm sorry.
I'm Shelly.
Shelly, all right. Shelly just asked the question, wanting to know the origin of the tile sketches on the Cirque du Soleil album. So
that's Chris, that's your department. It's your fault, I should say.
When 2 years ago at Icon in Long Island, which is where I'm actually from. These two nuts were there. And then they asked me when we went out to eat, said, hey, we're doing this super secret all-star comedy sketch thing, and we'd like you to be a part of it. And my first thing in my mind was, oh, great, oh, I feel I belong to something. And the next thing that popped into my head was, you know. Now, it actually did spur from something, one of the Beavis and Butthead episodes where Tom Anderson is pushing his car through.
Roof and tile? Anybody?
Spanish roof and tile.
Where's that damn hippie clerk?
So I thought, all right, well, yeah, well, Anderson, you know, he's kind of, but what if a complete blithering idiot just had it in his crawl that he wanted tile, so... Yeah, you know what would be funny is if this guy just goes into all the wrong places asking for tile. Okay, well, that was like a year and a half or 2 years ago. and I just kind of sat there and then...
Well, it was like once we finally got to the point where, yes, we're actually doing this album, we're going to get together in Rochester and record it, and there was about 50 or so sketches that, you know, were written between myself, Shoebox, and Devo, and then Chris hadn't gotten around to actually writing anything and putting it up on our Google group, Google Docs group, so he basically wrote all his sketches on, in the plane on the way to Rochester, and that was one of the ones he showed up with.
And he's walking around going, Tyler, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? Because I hadn't read the sketch yet. So I'm like, what?
And I said, you'll see.
You'll all see.
So then we're recording it. And I still hadn't read the sketch. They didn't give me a copy. The only one I'm in is the Wendy's one. So I didn't even bother reading along for the other person. And he's going back and forth. Oh, Tyler. And I'm just kind of tuning out, reading ahead to the other sketches we have to do. And then they start doing the last one, which is Chris and Luke. They're going, Tile, Hanja, okay. And I'm listening to this.
This way you guys don't have to go back and forth.
Oh, all right.
Cool. I'm getting a copy because I'm mature.
And I start cracking up. And they're going back and forth. And it just kept getting stupider and stupider. And I just kept laughing harder and harder. And I was trying not to ruin the tape because we all were on mic at the time. So I'm sitting there with my scripts in my face like this,
you know, shaking,
trembling, trying not to laugh. His fiance is standing next to me, and she's there looking down at me, and she goes,
I didn't know
she
that.
Is, yeah.
She is so used to this crap by now.
Oh my gosh.
That's hilarious.
He's gonna learn something new every day. The tape did break down.
Yeah, we were like halfway through the last, and then like everyone just lost it, and then like, you know, I started like laughing, and then intentionally going like snorting, and then his wife Kim is like, he's snorting, and you're making noises.
It's completely that ended up being a bonus track.
Yeah,
we regained our somehow regained our composure. Continued from our let's take it from
Tile hand job or hand job Tile.
Take two.
Right.
Then I sniffed that bit out and said, bonus track.
Although
I still laugh when at the end when he goes, oh, hand job. And then Kim goes, okay. It still cracks me up.
I don't think that line could have been delivered any more perfectly than that one. I mean, a vast majority of the stuff was one take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes it was, I think we need to say that line a little different. There was very little of that. We just went with it. And
nice.
Wow.
Yeah, we planned an entire weekend of this. They basically, under really annoying circumstances, they all flew to Rochester, New York, because that's where I am and I have a basement. It would seem to be a good midpoint for all of us. Really. And we planned the whole weekend. We figured the whole weekend we were going to be doing this. So should we book a show over here? Or we're going to be in the same place. We could do a comedy show. No, we're going to be down working on this the whole time. And we finished almost all of it. Like, what, Saturday?
The first day, yeah.
The first pretty
we,
much.
We did, well, what, 29 sketches?
I put the strips in order from shortest to longest. So yeah. We literally got the first 29 tracks, like, the first day. And then, you know, increasingly less tracks as the second and third day came on because we were doing longer bits. Like,
yeah.
There's this one sketch that didn't even make the album that's like 9 minutes long that will eventually...
Damn near 10.
Yeah. It'll eventually be heard.
We should mention that this also was like about 5 years in the making,
yeah.
Writing all these sketches. The weekend went by really fast. Making it to that point took forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to set up a time we'd all get together or when we all would agree, okay, well, yeah, we're working on all this other crap. We all have albums of our own. But we're going to put that on hold for a minute and make this happen. That took forever. But we finally did it, and you were saying.
The other part of the story of, you know, it was the three of us from, like, you know, 05 to,
yeah.
to most of the way, you know, into the thing. And then a year and a half ago, you asked him to join. The hinge pin of that was you just saying, well, I'll go look at their Google group and see what these sketches are like. And there's like, they're numbered 1 through 50 in whatever order. And the one he happened to pick to read to be the first one is a sketch he wrote called Pizza Time, which let's just do it really
ring.
Quick for that. Ring.
So ring.
It's something along these lines, though. Papa's floaty bones, everything but the Jesus buttered pizza emporium. This is God speaking. Can I help you?
Oh, would you like a Delaware?
Would you like
style
to try
sausage?
Would you like a Delaware style sausage and pepperoni for $13.95?
No, I want pizza.
Ah, very excellent. We have pizza, my friend. What are you getting it for?
It is for my grandmother.
No, it certainly is not. Grandmothers do not enjoy pizza. They haven't enjoyed pizza since the great mining disaster of 1843.
No, I will eat it in front of my grandmother.
Oh, no shit. Shit ass. Shit cock fuck Christ.
Yes.
Shit cock fucking fuck shit ass Christ ass.
Shit.
Shit ass shit.
It's way better than that.
Yeah,
really.
It basically goes on like that for, you know, two pages and then just ends with, okay, that'll be $13.95.
No, thank you. I am opposed to items.
Click, click.
Golly, I guess I'll have to cancel my liverwurst party. Okay, everybody out of the clown! So that was the first thing he read of like what we were going to do, and he was like, do I want to be involved with this?
You just totally ruined my vision for that sketch.
I'm sorry.
The first thing I thought was, okay, this is not comedy.
This is art.
It's
performance.
It's perform. Well, particularly now I've warmed to that sketch quite a bit, and now there are things I want to do when we perform that sketch. Now, and you didn't do it. I want you to say, you know, when we do that, they're going on. You're a great shitting fuck, and he's going, grandmother. And during all that, I want him and me to be doing like, you know, interpretive dance. And things like that. It's like.
We performed it at Penguin Con 2 weeks ago, and it got interesting reactions.
Yes.
Because, like, I'm reading this script, and then at one point I just took my finger and I just started, like, pointing at the words and saying, shit, fuck, Christ, shit, cock, ass. Page 2. Ass, shit, yeah. So,
try not to reuse any combinations.
Yes. But there was the very first thing you recorded by accident was pretty epic.
Oh.
Because Chris had, like, set things up, hit record. We weren't really aware that it was recording, but we knew the mics were on, and he, like, went to the other room, and then...
Went to get a soda upstairs.
Yeah. And we were sitting there with headphones on, microphones in front of us. I just got bored.
He's talking about, I should have brought a...
I had a sinus infection.
Yeah.
I was just getting over a sinus infection while we were recording it. So I'm talking about, you know, I had all this nasal sprays and stuff to, you know, keep my nose clear. And I was talking about how we should have brought it, and all of a sudden...
Everybody. So we got to this whole thing. And I'm hearing this from upstairs. In his kitchen.
But the weird thing is, the three of us stopped at the exact same moment. And then I think it's you said, how did we all know to stop that? And then it's like, it'd be cool if that was recorded. It's Chris. Yes! Are we recording? It's rolling, baby! We're like, yeah!
So I got lightning in a bottle. I got the lightning
really in a bottle. Is that really how Chris sounds in your mind?
Well, it's the far away Chris.
Okay. Yeah. I went, yes!
Oh, okay.
It's rolling!
Oh, okay.
So yeah, so that's another one of the outtakes.
And the other outtake that we improvised was the... was the Sesame Street aliens, the yip. He started doing that, and then Luke just sits there and he goes, ooh, dildo. Ooh, dildo. I broke up laughing. And that was not being recorded. So Chris very quickly goes, okay, let's do that again really quick. You know, hit record. And they start doing it, and I'm still laughing. And I couldn't join them until like three quarters of the way through. I finally got in at the end. But because I'm sitting there like, you know, like this, trying not to ruin the good take.
Oh. And then we build it. And then he goes, yip.
Brought to you by the Children's Television Workshop.
Ooh. Oh boy.
So.
And the sketches were falling out of our asses, weren't they?
They were.
So how often does it work in the first time? Is that exceptionally rare for you guys?
What do you mean, like for...
Scripted or non-scripted? You mean
either.
doing a take?
Yeah.
Or
either.
Ooh.
I think most of them went first try.
Yeah.
Except when your FireWire interface gave us trouble.
We had a few that we like would flub in the middle and kind of go back and go on and edited those later.
Yeah.
We didn't worry about trying to get it. Yeah.
Hi.
It's like, because we had no specific, like, one person is the director of the sketches. It was mainly, like, whoever was the principal person who wrote the sketch, who had, like, the vision in their head of, oh, it should sound like this, would kind of step up and be like, you know, if one of us felt like, oh, no, you do that line again, but say it more in this way. Cause
that worked out really well, actually.
Yeah.
There was, like, no ego clashing whatsoever.
I think a lot of times I became the de facto like voice caster, you know, just kind of like, who's doing what? It's like, all right, you're this guy, you're this guy, and I'm this, and you're this. Okay, go. And then we just...
And except...
Yay, somebody made a decision.
That helped immensely because we could keep going, yes.
With the possible exception of the fact that in my mind I was saying, I'm a professional voice actor and I know what stuff should sound like. And yes. You know, just a couple of little times I was like, yeah, can we do that one again from, you know, just a little bit more of it? But then again, they did that, you know, to me when I was doing, like, the God sketch, you know. And so, who wrote that?
Me.
And you were saying, but maybe it should sound more like, in the spirit of me. Oh, I know what you're trying to get across now. So we were bouncing ideas off each other, you know, left and right. There was so much bouncing, I think I lost 3 pounds, even though we got massive pizzas.
We had some barbecue, that was for
nice. Oh. And you can see said barbecue in the inside of the album. Yes.
So pictures of us with the barbecue.
Kim actually said that, she and Sarah were talking about, this sounds like Mel tooting her own horn here. Kim said it was, that she was kind of a... Kids are kind of amazed just watching us work on this and the way we were bouncing shit back and forth and making things happen and going forward. It was kind of amazing watching it happen.
Instead of stuff getting bogged down in committee, you know, because especially with four extremely creative people.
We should just form a software company right now.
IPO, anybody? IP freely. No, that's not it.
Yay. So, any other questions about Cirque du Soleil or about either any of us individually, or?
Yeah, what program do you guys use for your editing and stuff?
What program?
Like software.
Cubase?
Not anymore.
No?
No, ever since I upgraded I have a Mac at home, and I upgraded to Leopard about a year ago, I believe, and, I was using the demo version of stuff for a while. But I use Logic, specifically Logic Express. And Amadeus for audio editing, or for like waveform editing. I recently tried a new MIDI sequencing program, and I can't remember what it's called. Something weird.
Fruity Loops?
No.
I thought you said
ResonX.
I forget. I forget, but yeah. My computer's too old to... The MIDI in Logic just doesn't work because my computer's too old.
It doesn't count up to one. It just passes zeros and halves.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sure.
Audio editing-wise, I use Adobe Audition, which is what Adobe calls Cool Edit now that they bought it. Most of the actual stuff I put together, I started using this very old DOS-based program called Impulse Tracker, just from back in, you know, just after the days of mods and stuff like that. I've moved on to a Windows-based clone of Impulse Tracker. So I'm moving it, really moving it really fast. That's where I do most of the music on, along with some live keyboards and, of course, vocals on top of that, and all that is recorded and mixed in Adobe Audition, which I paid for.
I mainly use Adobe Audition these days. I occasionally use...
Yes, I did not know that.
I in fact, do it.
I know, because I saw it on his computer.
And I occasionally will use a program, Acid 6.0, when I do stuff that's a little more like looping, you know, sampled beats or something like that, like the Dada slide I use that program for. I occasionally will use the Goldwave program just to record individual components that I'll usually take after I record that or mess with it. I put it into, you know, the main track of Adobe Audition.
It's an easy utility for individual waves.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a multi-track of any sort, does it?
Not really, no.
It's got a lot of good functionality.
Which one? Goldwave?
Goldwave.
Goldwave? Yeah. I was using a copy of Nuendo for a number of years, but I went ahead, I formed a company for my voiceover, my voice acting, and I thought, you know, now's the time, because I built a studio in my house and got a lot of expensive crap in there, I thought, you know, I'm really making money as a voice actor. Maybe it's about time I really, you know, did what I had to do. Nuendo was really surplus for what I needed to do for the music end of things. So I purchased Cubase 5, which is what I'm using now for multi-tracking and MIDI stuff. And so I'm using SoundForge Pro, which I've been using since, my gosh, I don't know, you know, the 1.5. I've been using, you know, copies of SoundForge, and I bought it a few versions back. I love it because I can do many things to my voice, and, you know, taking. For me, it's very helpful when I get, like, if I'll get voice tracks from another voice actor or actress who doesn't maybe have very good soundproofing, and like we were doing the other day, isolate the noise and then you the noise down.
Because I'm entirely a self-taught, you know, engineer mixer thing, and I, you know, a lot of the times feel like, God, I totally don't know what I'm doing. I'm faking my way through this. And having Chris come over to my place and look at my setup, and he expelled some wisdom upon me, so I think things will be easier for me.
Expelled.
He expelled something on you.
Did we answer your question?
Yeah, I was really worried. I was originally using Pro Tools and Reason in my music production class, and I'm cheap, so I was using Audacity in my house, so I was curious if there were any good suggestions.
Cubase is very good.
Yeah. Cubase is excellent.
I actually prefer it to Logic, although I haven't tried the most recent version of Logic because my computer won't love it. So, but it's funny. I learned on Logic before Apple bought it and hated it. It was the most unuser-friendly program I'd ever touched. So I switched to Cubase, and once I wrapped my brain around how everything works, because audio software is just notoriously convoluted. I got the hang of Cubase and really liked it. And Logic is similar now, but there's still some...
It seems pretty intuitive to me, but then again, I was coming off of Nuendo, which is, you know, like Cubase on steroids.
Yeah.
It's got all the film production stuff that I never used, so when it came time when I was going to buy a program, I thought, geez, Nuendo is going to cost me, you know, $1,600. Do I really need... What am I giving up by... Really not all that much for like $1,000 difference. Then I'll buy Cubase. And, you know, I don't regret for one second that I did. So, but, you know, I know a lot of voice actors that use Audacity on a regular basis for what they're doing. You know, if you're just doing one mic, one channel, one mono, they seem to, you know, it works all right for them. I need a little bit more than that.
Yeah, I do all of my own stuff, so like I'll be on bones and I'll be on guitar and I'll be singing, and I just find it really hard synchronizing all the tracks on Audacity.
Audition is really good with that. I had no problem figuring it out.
I don't know which
ones? Adobe Audition. The multi-track thing. I haven't used a lot of these other things, so I have nothing to really compare it to, but it was really easy to figure out how to do the multi-track, and syncing it up is easy. You can just throw a metronome on if you need to, but, you know, obviously it drums out first, but, you know, it starts playing while it's playing, you're recording over it. There's a record button for turning it on or off. You're either recording on this track or you're not recording this track. And the rest of it
It's like I've noticed when I record on Adobe Audition, like, you know, recording it, you know, in time with the music like you're supposed to, and then the recording itself is like, you know, just like a fraction of a second behind the reality.
Really?
So then I have to go in and like basically
lag,
like, you know, line it up.
You can adjust this. Check your latency
really?
And your sound card.
Yeah, no, that's, it adjusts
for the sound, use a good interface, don't use your onboard sound card.
You know,
please tell me how.
I just had to tell him that. You don't want to set it up that way because it makes it, you know, nasty.
Yeah, you change it to adjust for the sound. If there's a clock difference between your computer.
Yeah.
It can adjust for that. You just put it in and then it goes through one extra step to correct for that when it completes recording, and it does that.
Yeah,
it didn't happen with my old sound blaster, but my new sound blaster does.
Mm-hmm. I had to stop using my. I bought this, you know, fancy schmancy digital sound card years ago for my Mac, and I had to stop using it because it developed a clock issue. And I don't know whether it's the issue with my computer, the upgraded processors I put in it, you know, Leopard, or a hardware problem with the thing itself. But what would happen is the computer would wake up from sleep, and everything would be playing at half speed. So, you know, instead of, you know, the alert sound on the Mac, instead of boop, I hear boom, you know, and all the songs I play, you know.
Alfie! Patton Oswalt references for the win.
All right.
Always.
So are there any other
bought a USB microphone so I could go directly into the computer, and then I bought a USB 2 audio interface so I can plug in my keyboard and stuff, and that's been working really well. There is some lag because it's USB, and I'd prefer a FireWire one, but I couldn't find a good one. What are you doing, Luke?
I want to look at one of these.
Why?
So I can think of things to talk about.
Doesn't the Apogee run on FireWire? That's Mac only.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, are there any other questions that don't...
Well, I'm going to be upgrading my studio once we move.
Don't get us starting about talking about tech, apparently.
Yeah. So I'm going to be calling you for advice on...
I enjoy cartoons!
Okay. I was just wondering how difficult it was for you to take over the partial eclipse.
That's a completely different subject. How difficult it was. Well, here's how it worked. Rob told me a few months in advance that this was that he was planning on stopping unless he could find someone to take over. And he says, in all honesty, I would consider you if you think you could do it. I said, I have absolutely no idea whether I can do that. I've never tried taking a piece of clip art, repeating it three times, and telling a funny story with it. Strangely, that has not come up before in my life. So I tried, and I ultimately came up with a few demo strips, and I'm like, okay, they sounded, and then, you know, spend a little time with it. The same thing always happens to me when I write a strip. I think it's funny when I come up with it, and then when I'm done with it, I have absolutely no idea. So I kind of had to show it to Rob, and he looked at it and said, yeah, this stuff's really great. And so he said, do you think you can do this two times a week? And I'm like, sure, I'll give that a try. It'll be something different. So, yeah, I said, okay, so I made 2-3 months worth of clips. So I was set, 2 months worth. And those are all posted now. I no longer have any extra to go back on if I'm behind or whatever. But,
you should probably do some on the flight back.
I'm planning on it. Because one's got to go up Monday night. I have like scripts written, but I tend to write the same way I write my music, by which I mean on the toilet at work. So I find clips that look like they might go somewhere from this clip art collection I have, and I put them on the template with no text on them whatsoever. I throw that in a notebook, take the notebook with me wherever I am, and when I get a spare minute, I'm on the toilet at work usually, I try writing scripts around and see where it goes. So you'll see a strip that may have taken... And they have just immediately occurred to me, and bam, it's on the paper. And you'll see some that probably took me weeks. You're going back and forth at different stories. It's like, should I go this way? Or, the one with the Indian on the horse without legs went through many modifications before coming up with something that most people didn't like. But, yeah, I'm thinking about maybe in December doing something where I take the ones that didn't go over too well and redo them completely in a different direction with some other idea I had. It's called Do-Over Month. But I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it's been fun. It's been a whole lot of fun writing that, basically. I wouldn't say it wasn't easy because it's a different state of mind. It's a different kind of thing for me. I haven't done that kind of thing before, but it's been, as response gets better, which is hopefully because I'm getting better and not just because people who can't stand me are going away, although I'm sure there's some of that as well, because I write very differently than Rob. There's no question of that, and many people point that out. The first comments of, if you read from when I took over, the first comments for a while are, wow, you're not Rob, wow, you're not Rob, wow, you're not Rob, and they've finally kind of gone to, hey, this is pretty good, or I don't like this because of this, rather than just that, which is nice.
Hey, you're not Rob!
I'm enjoying it, I think I'm doing okay at it.
Well, I mean, both Russ and myself are thoroughly enjoying it, but I was just wondering how it was from your perspective.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the living crap out of it. I want to keep doing it for as long as I can keep up with it.
Cool.
If only there were some kind of CD that involved both you and Rob that she could purchase.
Yeah, gee whiz. That would encapsulate both comedy.
It's a Luke Ski moment.
For the Luke Ski moments of your life.
Just so you have a recording device, I'm thinking you need to plug stuff.
I'm
trying to love the way you work. I don't know what you really do.
Oh, dude. One of the things that me and Rob talked about doing for the FUMP was putting a one-panel partial eclipse comic in with the mailing for subscribers only as a little bonus thing.
Really?
So if you have any...
When did you talk to him about that?
It was a long time ago. It was a year or two ago.
I'm not trying to take it back or anything.
No. But if you have any single-panel ideas that won't work as a three-panel, do it up and send it to me and I'll print them up and put them in with it for the subscribers.
See? The future of stuff happening before your eyes.
See, we're doing business here.
It's a beautiful tomorrow.
Nobody's drinking coffee.
I'm drinking coffee.
I was.
I'm drinking soda.
I'm going to be.
So it's a coffee club. You have to drink coffee or we're just going to end this.
We've had the coffee.
Just Canada, drink coffee, for crying out loud.
My question is, before you got into, you know, the pumpkin recording, what did you do before? What was your last kind of, like, real?
I still have a real job, unfortunately. I'm hoping I can quit it someday, but I'm a multimedia developer by day.
Okay.
After college, I taught at a community college for a few years, teaching Illustrator, Photoshop, and Quark. I have an art degree. And then I got a job doing web design and graphic design at a company, and then I moved to a medical education company. It was a very small company when I left. There were four people there, including the two bosses. And I was doing CD-ROM development, web development there. And as of about 2 months ago, I started working for BMW in New Jersey, doing their online training division, doing really mundane, you know, e-learning development.
It always seems mundane, like.
Well, even this is even more mundane than the others. I mean, I was burned out on pharmaceuticals, so I was really happy to leave the old place. Not to mention that the money is much better.
You were the guy sending me email.
Huh?
You're the guy sending the email.
Yes. I'm the one who runs the funk. I run the day-to-day operations of the funk.
I think he was speaking of pharmaceutical.
Oh, no. Sorry.
I just hired. Pills. I'm filled with pills.
Yes.
There will be no free Viagra passed out.
No. But, like we do things like, we were responsible for this whole ad campaign for this drug called Saltamox, which is a...
Saltamox?
Saltamox. It's a breast cancer.
That sounds like something Stephen Colbert made up.
Yeah.
Right. For cancer, we're going to feel
it's
bad.
It's a breast cancer word. Medication. Okay. And the idea is it's a liquid version of this medicine. This medicine's been around for years, and this is the first liquid version for people who don't like taking pills. And we went version after version after version of this ad of, you know, one thing after another, and it was, you know, a woman with a huge pill on her plate, you know, showing how hard it is for people to swallow pills, especially the elderly and stuff, and you know, and the person was like, well, you know, the guy at the drug company was like, well, you know, can you mix this with food? You're kind of implying that you're mixing it with food here. Like, no, we're not! No! And the ad, when it finally ran, was the Saltamox logo on a colored background with one bullet underneath it. It said a liquid version of tamoxifen or something to that effect. And then there was three counter bullets about all the bad things that can happen when you take it. Then there was the approved safety information, which is the full side effects lists of all the bad things that can happen when you take it. The other spread was the prescribing information. So this ad got whittled down from something that may have actually helped sell the drug to a logo on a two-page spread. And we were like, yeah, this is going to work. This is the greatest ad campaign that's ever been developed. And I just got sick of dealing with it. Yeah. I was so happy to move on. Because it was always one drug thing after. And my old boss just emailed me yesterday asking me if I could make updates to the Fragment website. So I get to deal with that when I get back. But it's freelance money. So.
I'm a software engineer. I've been a software engineer for the last 12 years. I have a degree in electrical engineering. Went directly into software from there, primarily embedded development. And then right now I've been doing Windows development for the last few years. But, Unix D7. What do you need?
No.
Coffee, creamer. Yeah, he's creamer.
Coffee? Coffee.
I need coffee. Proof that I have an art degree. I drew this.
Yes.
That's like super epic cover. I'm sorry. That's
cool.
I too am in no danger of giving up my day job right now because this is fun and pays for itself and so much for that, but it's not paying the bills and it certainly doesn't come with health insurance. I got kids.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? My day job doesn't cover health insurance anymore either, so
really?
I'm buying my own health insurance. Nice. And I'm still saving money based on what the old place's crappy coverage was.
You should go to a coffee class with, like, Molly Crew or something.
Yeah, I know.
They're not going to tell you about your software and their day jobs.
No, but this is fascinating.
They have real lives.
They have real lives.
We try.
Also, a wife and three kids.
Yeah.
Except Luke. I don't think Luke has a real life.
I do have a job. It's
It's not a day job. It's not a day job in the sense of like Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. But on the weekends, I'm not at conventions. I have a couple of places I go in the Chicagoland area and draw caricatures. I have a little caricature stand, so I set up and basically just you know draw caricatures for cash and stuff. On you know Friday night, Saturday all day, and then Sunday morning into the afternoon. I also have a website where I do freelance art, and also if people want to hire me for private parties to come out and, you know, just pay me an hourly wage to, you know, draw everybody at their birthday party or whatever for 2 hours, you know, I do that as well. But primarily, you know, all the money I make is on the weekends. And my fiance Sarah, who I just moved in with back in October, she is a, she's a hacker for a living for an advertising print company. So, you know, she's working the regular Monday through Friday 9-to-5 day job, and then I'm working on the weekend, so it kind of sucks because we really don't get too much weekend time to be together unless she's able to come with me to the conventions I'm doing. This year she's coming to less conventions with me because she's saving up all her days off work to for the wedding, which is coming up in September. So basically she's, you know, really cool and supportive because, you know, as long as I'm covering my share of the mortgage and the bills, you know, around the house, she's fine with me continuing trying to make my living with art and comedy. So during the week, Monday through Thursday, I'm basically doing my best to, you know, continue working on, you know, miscellaneous projects that, you know, most of which are lend itself towards putting a new song in the Fump, you know, or working on stuff for a new album. Like very occasionally I do projects that have like zero profit in it one whatsoever, but are just totally fun, like this puppet thing me and Carrie just did for YouTube, which was pretty neat. And you can just go to lukeski.com and scroll down the page a bit, you'll see it. And speaking of Carrie, she and I do a podcast every, you know, roughly every 2 weeks on a Tuesday night. We'll get together and, you know, just, you know, gab about miscellaneous stuff. I have an email address for the Bad Rapport thing in my phone, so if I ever think, well, that'd be a cool thing to talk about, I just send an email to that address, so that the day of the podcast thing, I can just go look up, like, oh, what are all the things I reminded myself to, and then come up with a little outline of things to talk about. It's, you know, it's mainly, you know, Luke likes to hear himself talk for, you know, 75% of the time, and then Carrie talks about stuff she does too. And we'll play like, you know, 4 or so comedy songs in there, and then Devo Spicer used to do his podcast Manic Mondays, had a segment called News of the Stupid, which he was so kind as to allow Carrie and I to take over on our podcast after his ended, so we do that segment as well. And I'm still, for the moment, doing my show Thursday nights, streaming live on Dementia Radio. I may put that on hiatus for a while, just to have more free time to work on my next album and work on the wedding. But for the moment, it's still on Dementia Radio Thursday nights. But yeah, that's, you know, kind of my weird...
So he's living the dream.
Living the dream to the extent that, you know, I'm not like, you know, living in a mansion and making crap loads of money, but I'm able to make a living with art and comedy, and that's really cool.
He's living the nightmare.
I'm sorry, Ian, are you signed up for this?
I like your badge. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you're just going to... I am, and I won't say the senior member of the troupe, I would have to defer to these guys as far as experience is concerned. I'm having my midlife crisis, and you're watching it right now, as a matter of fact. I've recently undergone, I guess, really just a whole big change, and I was a professional musician in Cleveland for many, many, many years, and my background and my degree is in music. I have a bachelor's in jazz studies, a real great degree there. That's why I rap with my music degree. I can get a job at Avis, yo. But I had a lot of real-world education coming up through college as far as, you know, how to act, how to be corporate when you have to be corporate, how to be a jazzer when you want to be a jazzer. I was in the tuxedo trenches with various bands for many years. Okay, could you please take a seat this time, ladies and gentlemen? Thank you. And so-and-so's going to throw the bouquet, and so-and-so's going to throw the bride, and... Yes, exactly. Uncle Schloin will now cut the chmala and say the chmotzi and the chen, And after a whole bunch of that, opportunity came up to make a move down to where my parents live, and I thought, well, I'll find a band down in North Carolina. Well, I got to North Carolina, and there really is no type of scene like that as to what I was used to, and I thought, change! Change! So I went a little bit hacky there. So I had been doing voice acting as a pretty much a sideline for a number of years, and I thought, well, I got to do something. So now that we have to internets, I moved into that more as the main focus and decided that rather than beating my head against the wall, because I had already burned out twice in playing live music on a weekly basis or even weekly on a regular basis. And I don't want to go back to playing jazz clubs for $20 a night and things like that. And I hate smoke and I don't really drink. So other than the tunes, man, what really is it in it for me? Had two kids. One of them did not make the move with us. He's back in Ohio and things like that. So I thought, hey, I'm going to have a midlife crisis. I might as well have a career change to go along with it. So I decided to focus more on the voice acting now, make that the central focus, formed a company, worked on keeping clients I had from the day, and doing commercials, doing e-learning and corporate narrations and things like that. And we've been down this road before.
Yeah.
And
your phone menu, come on, I love the phone menu.
Thank you for calling Power Salad Incorporated. We're something like that. No?
Okay.
We're not in right now. Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you for calling Ian. Your call is very important to us.
Okay. There are places you can call and hear him telling you what number to push to get to certain things, basically, at the point.
If you'd like to talk to our sales department, please press 1. If you're a three-headed purple thing, press 2. If you're pissed off, press 3.
Not including him on Circus OO would have been like the dumbest thing ever. He's brilliant with his voice. It's an amazing thing. But yeah.
So I liked, you know, Power Salad had been going on for a long time. Oh, we did radio comedy when I was in college. I was a... were any of the rest of us college DJs?
Yeah, I had Friggin' Hair.
Oh, we had both of you were on Friggin' Hair.
That's right.
And Ray TV as well. What's that?
Yeah, well, Ray, that wasn't like really broadcast. That was just me and my friends turning on a video camera and goofing around.
Oh, I thought it was on the radio or something.
No, Ray did get some of our episodes aired on like local access TV up in the Twin Cities at one point. But and Psycho Potpourri, which is the original name of the group I was in, I actually was as a pirate radio station my freshman year at college, but I only did like 6 episodes of it.
So all right,
that's
all right.
I got the name for that. Tonight.
Talking about me now.
Okay.
Hey,
home.
I had to get an FCC license in order to run the radio station. Yeah, so I was there training and like in communications and that kind of thing, learning to be a jazz DJ, and we had to learn to edit tape in those days, you know, things like that. And so I came up with some like-minded people at the station who this one gentleman liked to write strange comedy. Okay, good. And we had some other people. So we started Zot Theater, which was roughly monthly radio program that we produced at the college FM station. And I was the de facto voice guy, plus whoever else we could get in. We were not really concerned with quality. The other member of the troupe came up with our motto, which was, who do we use as actors? Anyone who's breathing. We'll take them. We produced about 23 specials. We had a couple of hits on the Dr. Demento show back in the mid-80s. Parodies, there were some parodies, a couple of sketches. And it was from there that the whole Power Salad thing started to go. But I kept the voice thing going as like a, you know, oh, sideline. And it would build and build and build. And then, of course, everything else I said before. So I am very happy to be part of this thing because not only do I get to do a lot of funny voices, but I'm working with, I think, like-minded comedy guys from a comedy standpoint. And I said, I'll do it if I can be the producer, because I'm like a recording freak, so.
And if you hadn't been the producer, I don't know how we would have gotten the album done.
Yeah,
at least,
I don't think
or at least not.
We'd still be working on it.
Not to the quality level and not in the timetable we had wanted, and he made the magic happen, so.
Okay.
I think quality.
It'd still be bugging me to do it or something.
When's the tile shirt going up on the Circus Olet store?
I know.
When's the Fump app going to be on the iPhone?
No, the Droid.
Yeah. The Fump.
That's because
I want to make one.
That's about the only thing I know. I don't know any of this. See, these guys, these are the wizard guys.
And the sixth, or the fifth and sixth members of Cirque du Soleil seem to be his wife Kim and my fiancée Sarah, because we needed actual women to do parts, and they were there.
Yeah, we needed girls for parts, and they were the only ones who had girl parts.
In fact, there's track 16 is called "The Track You Will Listen to the Most on This Disc." It's very epic and features the two of them, and he wrote it.
And less. Awesome. that's a good one.
We got to go pretty soon because we need to go grab some food before the masquerade.
Food.
So.
Yes. Well, we don't have to go right to the beginning of the masquerade, though, right? We want to be back.
Not really. I should probably check in with Gopher and let him know we're going to eat so that if we're late, not to freak out.
Yes,
but,
are there any other burning philosophical questions?
I should say thanks for assuming we do this for a living.
Some of you had jobs on the side. It's interesting to know where you come from, you know, when you're not doing music.
I do try to downplay the day job because it's the type of thing where, you know, the perception of success breeds success.
Yes.
People think you do this for a living, they're gonna take you much more seriously.
Absolutely.
So I don't say, hey, I don't go up on stage and announce, hey, I do e-learning for BMW, because nobody cares.
So you guys were saying that you were producing new albums individually, or Cirque du Soleil, or all of the above?
There will be a new Devo Spice album this summer. At Nerdapalooza, I'm planning to release it, which is July 16th and 17th in Orlando, Florida. So I have about 5 songs to complete and 2 I'm editing, and I need your vocals for that one.
The one I was supposed to get done last weekend.
Yeah. So that's going to be eating up my life for the next few weeks. And then we do have a whole bunch of recorded Cirque du Soleil material that we're making on the first album that's going to go on the second.
Actually, one of those tracks was put up at the Fump this week. It's a sketch called Death Works SKG. So you can download that for free over at the Fump.
Yes.
So
what am I doing? Oh,
what I'm doing?
When's the new Worm Quartet album coming out?
I've never heard that one before. After having a kid, I'm not putting out an album every year or two anymore. So I think it was a 3-year lag between the last one, and we're working on that for the new one. If I get one out this year, it will be a 3-year lag. I'm working on it. I probably have a good half an album recorded already. I just need to, most of it's been released on the public. So we'll see. I'm working on that. I have another side project in the works as well, which would be with an actual band. It's kind of a pop punk sort of thing, but still not as in your face funny as I hope Worm Quartet is, but you know, more so. But interesting stuff. I'm looking to do different things here and there. I mean, I basically like. We'll see. I'm dodging the question, basically. I'm not sure. I'm working on it,
also a viable way to answer things.
Okay. There will be. It will exist at some point. Not in the past, but in the future.
Yes. So basically, back in 2005, when I decided, okay, I'm going to try to do this for a living, I came up with this business model based on Gen Con Indy, which used to be in Milwaukee and was just called Gen Con. Which is the convention where I first started performing and, you know, releasing CDs and selling it. So it's kind of the beginning of my career. The home of the original Lutsky fan base is Gen Con Indy. So, and I perform there every year during the judging time of their masquerade, and I also do other, you know, shows, and they give me a space in their big exhibit hall in the entertainment spotlight area. And, you know, basically every year since 2005, you know, at that con, I put out a new CD, or in 2006 it was a DVD, but basically it's like if I have a new album done every year, then every time I go back to each of these cons that I, you know, frequent annually, every time I go back, I have at least one new CD to sell, which, you know, I'd sell for like $15. So as long as it's like every time I go back to the con, I have at least one new product that a loyal fan could pick up, you know, for a reasonable price, then that will make me the kind of income I need to make to, you know, make enough of a profit here that I can justify continuing to do this for a living. So, you know, my problem lately is that I kind of needed to slow down my production of songs. When the Fump started in 2007, for the first 3 years straight, I had at least one track up at the Fump every month, which helped my business model. So it's like, oh, another year has gone by, here's 12 more tracks, I just got to finish another, you know, handful more, and then there's a full album. And lately, just because of miscellaneous circumstances, I haven't made quite as much material, now I'm like kind of looking down the barrel of August. It's like, okay, I got 2 months left. I want to try to get as full an album as I can. What can I do? So I've been emailing and talking on the phone with, you know, my friend Jared Ringel from Possible Oscar, Bob Emmett from Project Sisyphus, my brother JT, and a handful of others, basically saying like, okay, I certainly have enough ideas to fill out this album. I just need to know if I can get the music and get the songs written and record them. And I talked with Sarah about it, and you know, she agrees that, you know, it's the thing that makes sense for me to attempt to do. You know, but you know, if you know, assuming that I pull it off, I mean, I already booked a Gen Con, so either way, I'm performing at Gen Con. You know, if I'm gonna, you know, basically turn my life into album for the next 2 months, that, you know, once it's over and I get back from Gen Con, it's like, okay, now she owns me. It's wedding time. wedding. You know, and hey, I'm totally cool with that. So. So yeah, but I am overjoyed that we got the Cirque du Soleil album put out. I mean, like we've been saying, this been this 5 years in the making thing. It's like, I'm a very happy guy. I love my life right now. I have a kick-ass fiance. I'm doing awesome things with my friends. I mean, things are great. So, you know, the whiny bitchy things I complain about on my podcast at no end, you know, is small potatoes.
I would like to put a new album out, and I will very soon, sometime. But partially because I play all the instruments and sing all the vocals on all my songs, except where absolutely necessary to bring somebody else in. It's very labor intensive and time consuming, and I can't just plop songs out. Power Salad is two members. One of them just doesn't sing or play anything. Craig is the lyricist and idea man about the band. Between that and life and trying to build the voice career and the fact that I seem to be doing everything for everybody else in the dementia community.
I'm putting out a best of set with 40 tracks. Can you master all of them for me, please?
Okay. You and I have done nothing so far.
I know, except one little live version of JRO where I blow into my melodica and he bangs on it. That's about the only collaboration we've done.
Right.
Basically, I used to.
Chris, I'm writing a song about airplanes. Can you send me this voiceover thing for the pilot?
By tonight? I'm like, I was going to go to bed before I got up tomorrow morning, but I can do that because I forgot when you asked me the first time. But the other folks, too. And it's what I love doing. I also do a lot of vocals, both lead and background, for another group that Luke mentioned, one of the members, Bob Emmett of Project Sisyphus, works with a phenomenal parodist out of Utah. I don't even know what his real name is. He goes by the name of Spaff.
His name is Matthew Spafford Sumson.
Oh, really?
I know because I write his checks every month.
Well, he just goes by Spaff. And he writes unbelievably phenomenal parodies. And he's on the phone quite often, either with Robert Lund or as part of another group, Money Shot Cosmonauts,
yes,
which is typically Bob doing the music and whoever of his L.A. crew will do vocals. And
you ever see the Dr. Demento show coming back from MarsCon once? And like 8 of the songs were written by Spaff.
Yeah.
It was amazing. They were written for Mark Gunn and the Money Shot Cosmonauts. I think it was insane.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, go on.
No, well, that's it, you know, so... Spaff got wind of what I do as far as singing in character, singing harmonies. I'm very thankful to whatever Flying Spaghetti Monster is out there that I got the skills and talents that I've got. Excuse me, sometimes it's a mixed blessing because it's like, do you know how to do that? Yeah. Can you sing like the Mirror in Snow White? Yeah. Can you master these? You know, okay. Can you do this 6-part vocal harmony? Okay. Yeah. Sure. Not that I mind. And I don't. I don't mind. Because it's like, oh, good, this is less real life stuff. I have to work. I can go in my studio and just go, that note's a little sharp. I can, okay, good, I fixed that. Okay.
If any of you heard my song Battlestar Rhapsody on the Target Audience album, he's the one that made that not suck. Well, and Shoebox. And Carrie. The three of them. Just ignore me. Pretend I was
whoopie doopie. We have fun.
But anyway, I will be recording more. I'm a more gradual, I suppose. I do Power Salad whenever I can. Most of what I'm putting out now is through the Funk, but I'm spread a little bit thinner, helping a lot of people out.
You have a new song coming up on the Funk.
I do indeed have a new song coming out on the Funk tomorrow. Or Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Tuesday. And it has to do with tomorrow.
Hmm.
Yay.
Yes.
Yay.
We pretty much have to shut up and get our merch.
Well, we're leaving the merch at the table.
Okay. Okay.
And we'll relock. Okay. And this time we're going to make sure that we're
locked. Well, alrighty then.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, appreciate.
Please come see us tonight at the Masquerade and see him tomorrow at 1
p.m. 1 o'clock.
I'll try. It's interfering with the art auction, though.
Yeah.
Or the
so
art auction.
Of the art
or part of the point, the art auction is interfering with
you. Are you saying that Power Sale is not art?
No, yeah. I'm saying.
But he's not for us.
And we will have to
go
for
sale.
And they can't take him home.
Are you saying Power Salad is not for sale?
Oh boy, Power Salad is for sale.
You're already.
All right. Well, this will end up in a special episode of my podcast, Bad Report.
This has been the Luke Devo and Shoebox Show, featuring Chris, otherwise known as
the Eight Nippled Beast of Wacky.
Yes. All right, and stop.
You're listening to Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport.
At Black Angus, your name is Peaches.
Leave comments for this episode at badrapport.com or call 916-LUKE-SKI.
Welcome to the Seaside Hotel. Can I help you?
I need a fucking room for July 13th.
I'm sorry, sir. We don't have any fucking rooms on that date.
What, seriously? You don't have any rooms?
No, we have plenty of rooms, sir.
You just told me you don't have a fucking room.
Yes, sir. We're all out of fucking rooms for the 13th.
Oh, sorry. I'll take a non-fucking room then.
Okay, sir. I'll set that up for you now. Can I see your ID?
Here you go.
All right. You're all set for a non-fucking room on July 13th.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Can I help you?
Yes, I'd like a room.
Sure, let me see what we have available. Just one bed?
Yes.
Okay, smoking or non-smoking?
Non-smoking, please.
Okay, fucking or non-fucking?
Honey?
What do you think?
Non-fucking will be fine.
Okay, here we go. Your room is on the third floor. Elevators are right down this hall.
Thank you.
Can I help you?
Yes, hi, I'm checking in.
Sure, what's the name on the reservation?
Watkins, John Watkins.
John Watkins? As in Whackin' with Watkins, the Cullen Masturbation Talk Show?
Yep, that's me.
Wow, I've learned so much from your show. I had no idea all the things you could do with a cantaloupe.
Oh yeah, they're very versatile.
Okay, it says here you have a non-fucking room. You won't be needing a fucking room?
Well, I plan to be masturbating a lot. I mean, a lot. Does that count?
With or without lotion?
With.
By hand or with an artificial vagina?
By hand.
Okay, then, you won't be needing a fucking room. Okay, you're all set. Here's your key. You're in room 114.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, we wanted to see about getting a couple of rooms.
Sure thing. How many nights?
Two.
Smoking or non?
Non-smoking.
Fucking or non?
Well, that's the thing. We wanted to see if we could get a fucking room with an adjoining non-fucking room for the kids. Can you do that?
Let me see if we have any of those available.
Oh!
Yes, we do. It's a king-size bed with an adjoining room with two twin-size beds in it.
Perfect.
Okay, I'll just need to see your credit card.
Sure, here you go.
Oh, wait, hold on. I gotta get this phone call. Hello?
Hi, I wanted to see about getting a motherfucking room.
Not at this hotel, sir. We're a respectable establishment. I'm sorry, sir. Sir, it looks like your fucking credit card was declined.
Oh, come on, let me see that. Oh, I gave you the wrong card. That was my credit card. Here's my fucking credit card.
Oh, okay, great. Anything else I can help you with?
Does the fucking room have a fucking refrigerator or a fucking microwave?
No, just a fucking toilet and a sink. If you'd like a fucking sink, that'll be $10 extra.
That won't be necessary. Will it?
Oh, come on, Mom!
How about a fucking closet?
This room has an extra large fucking closet. We do have another room available with an extra fucking large closet. If you'd like that one instead, it's $20 more.
No, that's fine. I think we're good. Honey?
No, we're fine. Let's go.
Great. Here are your keys. Enjoy your fucking stay.
Excuse me, where's the fucking pool?
Sir, that's disgusting. We don't have a fucking pool. You should have a fucking jacuzzi in your fucking room, but there is no fucking pool. Front desk.
I'm in my fucking room. Ow. And my husband, ow, keeps trying to ow, put his penis in my nose.
That's just fucking wrong. Hold on just a moment. Front desk.
Hi, I paid for a fucking room, but my hooker had a bad acid trip and spent all night lying on the floor screaming that the drapes were trying to eat her. Can you refund the difference?
Of course, sir. If you like, we can get you a new room or a new hooker.
No, I'll just get the refund.
Oh, okay, no problem. When you check out, you'll need to fill out the fucking failure form, and then your fucking credit card will be credited with the fucking difference.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, hello, I don't know what I can do to help you.
Achoo!
Okay. Can I help you?
Yes, checking in. Last name is Sanders.
Yep, here we go. Wait a minute. Were you just here with another woman?
Oh, that was my fucking girlfriend. This is my wife.
Of course. Okay. So that's a non-fucking room smoking for four nights?
Right, right. Hey, let me ask you, why do you have separate rooms for fucking? Can't you fuck in a non-fucking room?
Oh, no, sir. The fucking alarms will go off.
Oh, I see.
And then we'd have to change the sheets and clean the whole room. It's just a big hassle. We don't like to change the sheets in non-fucking rooms unless we absolutely have to. You know, saves water, better for the environment and all that.
Well, of course.
Here's your keys. You're up on the fifth floor, all the way down on the right.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, we're here to get a room.
We're here for the science fiction convention.
Okay, I have a non-fucking room with two queen-size beds.
Hey!
What?
Yeah, okay, that'll be fine.
Excuse me, I seem to have locked my fucking keys in my fucking room. Can you help me?
Sure, let me just call maintenance here. What room?
213.
Hi, Charlie. The fucker in room 213 locked his fucking key in his fucking room.
The fuck you say? Alright, I'll be right fucking down.
Okay, he'll be down in a few minutes.
Thanks.
No problem. Okay, you boys are all set. Here are your keys. Enjoy your fucking convention. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
Very funny.
Front desk.
I paid for a fucking room, and you gave me a fucking non-fucking room, you fuck! Now, I want to fucking fuck, but I can't fuck in a fucking non-fucking room.
Okay, sir, I apologize for the mix-up. What's your name?
Johansson, room 415.
Okay, yes, that is a non-fucking room.
No fucking shit.
Okay, now, you wanted a smoking room, right?
Yes!
Unfortunately, those are all booked up.
What do you mean?
There are no fucking smoking rooms available.
Are you shitting me?
No, sir, those rooms are sold out as well.
Fuck!
Not until we get you into a fucking room. Now, we have a fucking non-smoking room with two queen-size beds available. Would you like that?
No! I want a fucking smoking room!
Well, I'm sorry, sir. I can't fucking help you.
Well, fuck you then!
Well, no, sir. This is not one of those types of establishments. Why don't you go fuck yourself?
What choice do I have? Fuck!
Fucker. What a day.
And we're here.
Hey, how did that happen?
Time travel. It's the best.
Fling flangy.
So let's go to the questions, Chris Mezzalesta of Power Salad.
Let's do that. And finally, my Facebook will, in fact, let me do that. We got something from Wildcard, and this one would be for Luke. Were there any specific DJs that the DJ What's-His-Face character was based upon?
Actually, that question is for Devo Spice, and he's not here.
That's true.
Because he wrote that piece.
He wrote the sketch. I forgot. You played him, but Devo wrote
it. Yeah,
him, so.
I
haven't had any coffee yet.
Hey, everyone. This is Devo Spice. Luke asked me to call in because somebody had a question about the why I no longer listen to New York Hip Hop Radio sketch on the Cirque du Soleil album. He figured I would be the one to better answer that question since the sketch was my idea and I wrote it. The question was that sketch inspired by any DJ in particular? Yes and no is the answer. The whole sketch isn't one DJ. It's sort of an amalgam of DJs from one radio station in New York City, Hot 97 in particular. The two DJs are sort of three DJs who made my drive home a living hell when I chose to listen to that station were first and foremost Funkmaster Flex. Funkmaster Flex is still on Hot 97, and is one of the worst DJs I've ever heard. He's well-respected for some reason, but He puts out a lot of mixtapes, which is really cool. You know, he helps a lot of indie artists that way. But as far as scratching and mixing goes, I've never heard a sloppier DJ in my life. I mean, other than people who have no experience DJing, getting behind the turntables for the first time ever and trying to mix. That's about what he sounds like when he's on the radio. And he has a tendency to repeat the same 5 seconds of the song over and over and over until you are so sick of the song, you never want to hear it again. And the other DJ who is kind of mentioned in this song is Fat Man Scoop, who he's not a rapper, but he likes to think he is. He's one of those callback guys, kind of like Luke from the Two Live Crew, where he'll shout something and the audience will call it back, or he'll do a question and answer with the audience, you know, when I say this, you say that type thing. And he had this, his songs get played on the radio a lot, especially when he's the DJ, and he will mix them to no end. But his songs by themselves are repetitive. He has this one song where it's like, you got $100 bill, put your hands up. 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 You got $50 bill, put your hands up. You got, and it goes on like that. And he goes down to 20, I think, and he may go down to 10. And I was actually considering for that sketch adding into the thing, you know, doing that with 100 and then 50 and then 20 and then 10 and then 5 and then a single and then change and then finally, you got lint in your pocket, put your hands up. Or if you don't have a pocket, put your hands up, you know. And just going on and on and on. But I figured, you know, making fun of something that's annoying by making something else that's equally as annoying isn't really all that funny. So I ended up cutting that from the sketch. The other DJ who inspired that sketch is DJ Enough, who, and I don't think he's on Hot 97 anymore, nor is Fat Man Scoop, but DJ Enough had drops like you wouldn't believe. It was, you're in the mix with DJ Enough. DJ Enough is mixing this. DJ Enough is doing that. DJ Enough is on the radio. And that's where that whole bit came from with that. So it was kind of a mix of all three of those guys from Hot 97. And all of them use that stupid air horn sound. On top of the music. I don't know what the hell they think they're trying to accomplish by playing an air horn sound over the music and talking over it and everything, but it makes the radio unlistenable. And I've heard similar horror stories about hip-hop stations in other cities and stuff, but New York in particular is just god-awful. So there's your answer. Hope that answers your question. Talk to you later.
Frankie Crocker is spinning in his grave. Or is he dead? I don't know. Who is Frankie Crocker? I don't know.
Is that Ray Kroc, the guy who founded McDonald's?
Oh, he's like Mr. Black Radio in New York.
And then Wildcard asks...
He also asks, and if you are not already, and we're not, talk about the origin of Tile and the character.
Which you did in the thing that we did in the Coffee Clatch. So we kind
of, I did indeed, so...
So any other musings on that?
Muse.
You could talk about the reactions of the Canadians to the Tile character.
Yes, I could, in fact. As we had predicted, hoped and predicted and came true, it did take on a further life after we started performing it up in Canada this weekend at KeyCon in Winnipeg. And as in many other variations on the English language, there is now a new Canadian pronunciation of the word Tile. For whatever reason, it came out.
Yeah, it was like a couple of these guys who were fans, you know, were saying goodbye to us as we happened to be, you know, leaving the lobby of the hotel. And he turns to his friend. It's like, hey, let's do it one more time for them just to send them on their way. And they both did it. But they said it as if it was a two-syllable word, kind of like Ed McMahon used to say on the Carson show. Hey-o! They were saying it like that. Tile! It's like
one I and a whole bunch of L's, which is kind of backwards.
And it's like, you know, I didn't want to be all internet-y on them and be like, you're doing it wrong.
But like I do.
But hey, they're enthusiastic fans and we appreciate, you know, them and that it's awesome. And in fact, it was great that Leanna Kay and Gopher worked into the closing ceremonies in their little bit of what I learned at KeyCon this year. One of the things they said they learned was, Tile! So... I believe we sold one Tile t-shirt. We sold a bunch of Cirque du Soleil CDs. So, you know, hopefully, things are good.
Yeah, indeed-y-do. We have a question again for someone who is not here today, but Luke might be able to help with this. Durwood wants to know whose idea was Lukeski cereal, and how did the idea come up? Did he ever say anything to you?
Hello, this is Shoebox of Bolt Box and Circus of Wood, Parsley Clips, and some other stupid thing with Keith Casio music or some kind of crap in it. Anywho, I received a question, which was, where did I get the idea for Lukeski cereal? I see why there's some confusion about that. Lukeski is actually a comedy musician. He's been played on the Dr. Demento show. He plays a bunch of cons and stuff of that nature. You probably haven't heard of him. And then there's cereal, which is the thing you eat for breakfast if you don't have time to wait for a waffle to toast. And I combined these things together and came up with the idea of cereal that tastes like Lukeski. And I wrote a thing, and I wrote this whole thing, and I sent it out to the Circus of What group to see what people thought of that. And I got comments back, and one of them was from the great Lukeski himself. It turned out he'd been in Circus of What all along. Oh, mercy. I am trying to talk quietly because I'm leaving this message from work. Goodbye.
Speaking of Lukeski cereal.
Speaking of.
Yeah.
Why don't we speak of Lukeski cereal?
And actually, I'll finish that before I post this.
Okay.
So that we can tell people to go look for it.
Yeah.
And it'll be there.
Ooh.
Last night, after we returned from our arduous journey home and stopped by Carrie's place to check up on her kitty cats and give them kitty cat medicine and have Chris... look at her audio and say, it's dead, Jim. we came back here, and Chris wanted desperately to use the wacky puppets we have created for the Cooking by the Book parody and for the Baird Rapport video episode. To use those puppets to film something Cirque du Soleil related to put on the internet.
Desperately!
And we kicked it back and forth. We listened to the entire gamut of everything we recorded, and we came to the conclusion that the best thing to attempt to recreate quickly was Lukeski cereal. So I ran out to I whipped up an image on Photoshop. I went over to Kinko's and had it printed up big enough to fit on the front of a cereal box. And we quickly slapped together a video.
Slapped it. Oh, we slapped it.
So, yeah. So that, you know, that is on YouTube right now. There will be a link to it in the description of this episode. Or I'm sure if you go to YouTube and do a search for Lukeski cereal, you'll probably find it. So, yeah. So that's that.
What I'm afraid of is what else you might find if you search for Lukeski cereal.
And as far as why Shoebox wrote Lukeski cereal, I really don't know. I hate to you know, bomb out on you again here, but it's like, you know, it's you could ask that question about virtually anything Shoebox has ever written. Well, why did you do this? You know, there's pieces of Shoebox written where you can tell, oh, C is for Lettuce is basically a response to the hypocritical nature of parenting and how it affects entertainment and blah, 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 blah. But other things Shoebox writes, it's like, yeah, brain. So, yeah.
Brains. You're listening to Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport.
So, are there any other questions hiding out there?
It's sort of a question. Craig Marks of Power Salad asks a two-part question. The first part, how many throat lozenges does one need after doing multiple Gilbert Gottfried impressions? And part two, for the Marmaduke movie, should I see it in standard 2D or splurge for the IMAX?
For the first part, I didn't actually take any throat lozenges for doing the Gilbert impression, although I probably should have because I think I was either coming into or growing out of some kind of illness. I think it was coming out of. Which is why in some of the outtakes you hear me coughing and, you know, Diva Luke's dying, you know.
There was definitely, I must say, as the producer of the Circus of What, Procrastinators of the Apocalypse album, I do recall hearing an awful lot of mucus in the tracks from a lot of us, actually. A lot of, anytime the SN, whatever you call it, phonic, was spoken. A lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah. So basically, I think I might have done like a practice kind of get set up, set the levels take on the Gilbert thing, and then we just went for it. I think most of those three were the first take.
I believe so. There was one where we had to go back, catch it a little bit, but other than that, yeah, just we went, all right, up, go, and whoop, whoop.
The third one was that was the one that, you know, really I had to, you know, put all of my, you know, intestinal fortitude into it. Ugh. I was tired after recording that.
This album contains intestines.
So, yeah. So,
that appears to be the gamut. If I... Yep. I think that's probably the gamut here.
Well, let's just kind of recap and try to think of other musings we can do on Circus So What. First, I'll kind of recap the origins, because I don't think we mentioned that in the coffee clutch the other day, was that Shoebox, back in about 2005-ish, got this notion of, you know, he'd really like to do some, you know, non-musical sketch stuff, and he'd like to do it with some friends. So he brought the idea to Devo Spice and myself, and we thought, yeah, that would be really great. So we've formed a Google group, and we started writing sketches and putting them there, you know, just kind of like this, you know, kind of safety deposit box of comedy goodness, you know, and basically all of the sketch ideas I thought were really good, I stuck in there, and unless I thought that for some reason they specifically seemed more like a Lukeski thing than a group thing, in which case I would, you know, do them and put them on my albums that I put out since 2005. Excuse me.
Ugh. A lot of dragon.
And we went back and forth for a long time on what we were going to call the group. And I remember the name Two Mullets and a Bowl Cut was thrown around for a while. I really wanted to go with Geek Tragedy, but it turns out there was already a webcomic or something that existed, you know, that already like had like geektragedy.com. So we kind of made that for ourselves, like whatever we got, we were going to make sure it was something that we could get a URL for. And then somehow we landed. Somehow we landed upon the name Savage Dumplings.
Hey.
So that's what we were going to call ourselves for a very long time. In fact, I know that just as a means to try to kickstart the thing into existence, one of the years we went to Dragon Con, I tried to get Devo and Chu on stage for one of the big main stage shows so that we could like announce to the world that we were doing something, but nobody was paying attention to a word we said. Nobody retained anything, so it's kind of like that little announcement never even mattered. So time went on, and every so often one of the three of us would, you know, kind of, you know, get annoyed that this whole sketch thing hadn't come into existence yet. So one of us would be like, you know, come on, let's get serious. Are we going to do this or not? Because if not, you know, I'm going to, you know, take my sketches and go put them on my albums because I need more material. And then the other two would come back with, no, we're going to do this. Let's keep with it. We got to make it happen. All right, well, then let's make plans. And then, you know, things would never really quite happen. And then one of us came forth with the idea like, hey, what about Mr. Chris Maslesta? He seems to be, of like mind to us when it comes to things, and obviously he's an excellent producer, and he's got all these awesome voices. Why don't we see if we can get him? Maybe Chris is the missing element that will get this thing to kickstart itself into existence. So, I believe you said Devo and Shoebox asked you at Icon.
I was approached at Icon in 2009 in Long Island. He says, hey, we've been kicking this thing around for a number of years, and we were finding it difficult to get it off the ground, and, you know, would you like to be part of it? And I said, hey, great, but, you know, my initial fear was, yes, I've got this long history with Power Salad, Zot Theater, and all that, but, of course, I was really not a creative force, per se, behind Zot Theater. I wrote one or two things over the years, but if you want writing, I can try, but if you want producing and voices and crap, I'm your man. So, there you go. I'll be happy to do it. Honored.
And I can't remember. I think we kind of, yeah, we already covered that in the other thing, the coffee clutch, the whole you going to see, oh, let's see what they're trying to write.
Yes, let's see what we're going to be doing.
The first sketch you saw was Pizza Time, which was, yeah. We did Pizza Time live at PenguinCon, so some of you have heard the sketch, and some of you only have an idea of what the sketch is about. So we'll let you wonder.
It shall be on a future album.
Yes. So basically Chris was asked on, it was pretty early 09, wasn't it? Yeah.
Okay.
Icon. That was like in March.
March or April of 09.
And, you know, then things kind of coasted once again for several months.
Right.
And then, you know, it was like, it was kind of like Ratatouille. Let's do this thing! It was determined that the easiest location to do this at would be Shoebox's place in Rochester. So Chris packed up all his gear, flew to Rochester. Sarah and I flew to Rochester. Devo drove. And we spent an extended weekend. I think we arrived on a Thursday night, left on a Monday at some point. And just spent the whole weekend. I had arranged the sketches in order from shortest to longest. So day one of the three-day session, we recorded like the first 29 potential sketches. And then, you know, the other, by the end of the weekend, we had 52, of which we only determined two were really not working.
And they were both what I wrote.
No, you didn't.
Oh, really? No.
The Origins of Homosexuality.
Oh.
You did not write that one.
I didn't know that was one of the ones.
Yes. The Origins of Homosexuality and Terminal B were the two that we decided weren't working.
Oh, okay.
Everything else we thought was hunky-dory, you know, pretty much. But we still kind of felt like, all right, there's some material that if it doesn't go on the first album, we should throw it on the bonus disc for pre-ordering just because, you know...
We have fans.
Certain gems we wanted to, you know, have the full album treatment. And we also asked for some help in determining which material was going to end up on the album because we had the four of our opinions, but we all liked what we did so much it was hard to get perspective. So we asked four colleagues of ours to listen to all of the stuff we recorded and give us their opinions. And the four colleagues were, in no particular order, Rob Balder, Insane Ian, Sea Monkey, and Merle Lafferty. And we got back their feedback. And we were kind of hoping for it. It would be like, oh, well, you know, all four of them really love this thing, and all four of them really hate this thing. So that's an indicator. This thing is good. This thing is not good. This will go on the album. This won't go on the album. Basically, what we got was four completely diametrically opposed opinions to each other. How you can have four that are diametrically opposed, I don't know, but somehow we got that.
Quadrophonically.
It's like nobody all loved anything, and nobody all hated anything. The most... votes anything got in the plus or minus way were you know was like two, you know, so it's like, you know, I think it helped to some slight degree. I think it helped us make a couple decisions, but all in all there was no clear cut, you know, good, bad, whatever. So I mean, we still appreciate their input, and you know,
but it was worthless! Worthless, I tell you!
And it was my idea, so yay me!
Bang!
So, anyway,
what we learned from that experience was that people have different opinions on different things all the time.
So let's just kind of run through the track listing here to see if any thoughts pop out.
Well, I loved Escargot Flambé à la mode because it was funny, it was absurd, and it was noisy.
Yes. And Shoebox, you know, that was one of the first things he wrote. He actually wrote it. He had that sketch written before Faster Than a Speeding Mullet came out. And the version that is on the bonus disc for people who pre-ordered was something he and I recorded back then. And I did the voice much differently. I did it in kind of a nerd voice that I used in a play in high school that was, you know, just like...
Luke's yawning.
Yeah, so... okay, I mean... I'm trying to think of comments to say that aren't just like, well, I wrote this, and I wrote this, and I wrote this. You know, so that I can be like, ha ha, I'm going to take all this credit for blah, 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 blah.
Well, how about guess the
TNA VHS Rentalrama. I wrote that, and I'm particularly proud of it just because it's like, when you notice something in pop culture that nobody else really seems to have acknowledged, you know, it's, I mean, I know that In a rare HBO comedy hour, David Spade had made some comments on movies of this type when he was ripping on the USA Network, the version of it that existed, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Because they played those type of movies all the time. But other than that, I never really heard anyone kind of notice or mention this thing. And it's like, you know, they were everywhere. It's like, how come nobody, you know, and And, you know, I did notice that shift. It's like, I mean, now that Netflix exists, it's especially Netflix streaming and stuff like that, it's like all these movies are starting to, like, come back again because studios that own them, you know, are realizing they're sitting around collecting dust. It's like, hey, well, we can get residuals on this if we just throw it on the internet. We don't have to pay anything except for, like, a slight bit of a data charge, and we can make money off these things. So it's like starting – they're starting to, like, come back from the digital depths of VHS hell. But – I thought of this bit a long time ago. I wrote it, and even a couple years ago at one of the DuckCon conventions, Ookla the Mock was doing a bit where they were trying to do a parody of Mac versus PC commercials where it was acoustic versus electric, and they wanted to have other things to intersperse in between their bits, like commercials. And me and Shoebox were there, so they asked us to come up with commercials, and I'm like, all right, crap, I don't know what to do. Hey, wait. And I called Sarah and asked her, go to my Google Docs website thing, blah, blah, look for this, print it up and bring it here. So I actually performed on stage with Shoebox, DNA VHS Rental Rama, at DuckCon a few years back, and it actually got a really great crowd reaction. So, I was really insistent that this one make it onto the album because it's, you know, I thought it was really damn funny. And in fact, I'd like to make a video for that to put on YouTube as well. I just don't think using puppets would be the right way to go with,
not
the,
exactly.
with that one.
We did perform that, didn't we?
THS Rental what?
We did perform that at PenguinCon, did we not?
I think we did.
We did.
We did. Okay.
I was there.
We videotaped it. I mean, at this point, you have to realize, for me, Chris, every day is like 2 days. It's like,
yeah,
you know, and so right now, PenguinCon feels like a month ago.
Luke's living large.
So, Shoebox, who's the one who thought up the idea for the track you will listen to the most on this disc. So let's talk about the awesome de facto fifth and sixth members of Cirque du Soleil, that being Kim Christ and Sarah Trice.
The Cirque du Soleil ladies, not really auxiliary, they are integral. The ladies integrally.
Yes, and it's just awesome because there are so many people that, you know, it's like, oh, come help me. Do this thing really quick. Just do this. And they're like, no, I won't. I'm the... And they, you know, they're too scared. They're too shy. They're too embarrassed. Oh, my voice sucks. I can't sing. Blah, blah, blah. Excuse, excuse, excuse. And it's so nice to have people around where it's like, hey, will you do this thing to help me out? And they're like, yes. You know, so, you know, I think, you know, everything they did, like, there's nothing they did that I felt was like, you know, half-assed or not right or whatever. Like, no. What we got on the album and even on the stuff people haven't heard yet was pretty much, you know, dead on exactly what we wanted, like, super perfect.
No, they dug in. They really dug in and gave.
So peace out to them for that.
Yay! Yay, Kim! Yay, Sarah!
And, I can't remember if we've specifically mentioned this yet. So, you know, what we made the plans to get together for the weekend, and Chris hadn't really written anything yet. All the stuff Chris wrote for the album, he wrote on the plane rides out to the weekend, including all four of the tile sketches. Which you had initially conceived as being one sketch, and then we're like, no, these got to be broken up. These got to be spread out. And personally, I think they're better that way, because it kind of starts with a question mark, like, what the hell was that? And then it leads to, what, it's that guy again? And then it leads to, oh, it's a stripper. She has to deal with that crazy guy. That's awesome. And then number four is the payoff where he finally finds what he's looking for and finds like-minded, you know, people. So
the big thing that is the question that remains unanswered is, does he ever get the tile? I had never thought of that until this very second.
Well, it's implied, though, that he at least gets the hand job.
It could be. It could be.
I mean, we don't actually see it, but it's implied that it's coming.
When we we don't want to see it either. Particularly and I must again mention Kim. It's like, okay, we want you to portray I won't say mentally retarded, but very stupid girl clerk working in a home improvement store who is on staff only to give a hand job to this idiot who comes in looking initially for tile, but gets all his things mixed up so that he thinks he wants a hand job, which he probably should have gotten from the stripper in the club. But she goes, okay! And Kim portrayed that just beautifully, which I thought was hilarious.
And it was great at the live PenguinCon show that both Kim and Sarah said it in unison.
They stood up and said, okay! And scene.
Yeah, so...
It's been a huge...
By the way, she doesn't want you to know this, but it's probably kind of obvious. Sarah is the voice of CSI Dora.
Bye. Sped up just a little bit by yours truly. But I had no idea that I... Because I was thinking, what the heck contribution could I make to this thing? I don't know. And it was the first thing that popped into my head when Devo and Shoebox asked me over a year ago. Would you be part of this? Okay, well, how about this idiot goes to different places looking for a tile or something? And I had no idea it was going to take on the life that it has taken on. So I'd like to thank you all for sharing your tile memories and things like that. So
yes.
Yeah.
Dumb Fanfic Awards, I believe, was one of the first sketches that we started writing, me and Devo and Shoebox. I believe Shoebox had the initial idea, and then I jumped on board. I'm not sure how much of that was Devo, but, you know, the sketch was written to the point where the whole sketch was there, except for announcing the winner making his speech, and the post-speech thing leading up to the Ballad of Tasha Yar, because he had the lyrics to the Ballad of Tasha Yar written back in 06 or whatever. So... You know, that sat there, and I was kind of hoping, and you know, that somebody else was going to step in and fill that gap. And then finally, when it came down to, like, we got to get these sketches written, I'm like, all right, I'll step back in, and, you know, now that I've been away from it for a while, I can come at it with a fresh angle and figure out a way to write it. And I'm really happy with the speech I wrote for Trent Gobblestein, the winner of the Dumb Fanfic Awards contest.
I loved the names given to all the fanfic authors.
Yes.
Very strange and very far removed from reality.
We accidentally had two Gertrudes in there, and then
yes.
Shoebox had to change one of them to Bernard just to have it make more sense.
I should mention at this point that for those of you who are listening and are not yet aware that there is a Cirque du Soat fans page on Facebook, and we had nothing to do with it. It was put up by a fan. We got a fan.
That's so rare in this day and age.
Yeah. So you can check it out, Cirque du Soat fans, on Facebook, which is awfully groovy.
Oh, yes, and the Cirque du Soat commercial came together rather quickly, and I love my first quick and dirty attempts at at animation on a computer. You know, it was like I drew like four different chibis of each of the four of us, colored them, and made like seven different cells, so to speak, that I could alternate to get, you know, create the effect I wanted to go for with it. So that was kind of neat and fun.
And I went, hey, 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 hey. Yeah, that's pretty much my contribution to that. But that's on YouTube. You can see that still. Of course, we probably should do a new version that, you know, is available at baconnipples.com rather than premieres at MarsCon, because that has now passed. We should do a new Mach 2 version of that one.
So, yeah, over the weekend we recorded about 100 minutes of material. The CD ended up being 66 minutes long. We had the bonus CD. Blah, blah, blah. What that all means is that we basically ended up with about 27 minutes left of material that hasn't been heard yet. Although we did let one of those nuggets of joy come out because it was my idea to post it at the FUMP just before the release of the new Shrek movie, a sketch entitled Deathworks SKG. Another piece that was originally longer when written and recorded, but we edited it down to what we felt the, you know, core essence of the piece was. So, so that was nifty.
Weekend has question.
Oh.
Live on the tweet line. And, wish I could, it's on here. Max DeGroot wants to know, what do you use for your reverb effects? I used two different reverb programs, which are VST plugins for Cubase. One of them is called Roomworks, and the other one was called Reverence. Reverence seems to be
an acoustic modeling program that wants to replicate the acoustics of things like, you know, the Parthenon or the LA Coliseum or whatever the heck it is, various stone and or large otherwise. So for you may be referring to the God effects in the Bible, an audiobook, and for that I tried to find the largest type of space with a whole bunch of early reflection, an awful lot of space to it, and a very long decay time, yet one that would not turn my voice into soup. So I believe for the God effect I did use reverence, and for the rest of them, such as the bullhorn sound effect and the Charlie Brown and the bell tower sound effect in You Need Prozac, Charlie Brown, those are simply various settings within RoomWorks that I, you know, tweaked around till I got what I wanted, and it was groovy. So it was groovy. There's a picture of Luke and Steph looking like
we're about to swim with a manatee.
Swim with a manatee. Live on stage at SeaWorld, it's the Luke and Steph Show. And so, Max, that is what Salad hath wrought as far as the reverb is going. And you're listening to Luke and Gary's Bad Rapport, special half in the middle sort of Cirque du So What special podcast.
Yes, yeah, this is going to be episode 15 and a half.
15 and a half!
15.5.
I knew there was a number, but I saw it up there, but I didn't know what you were exactly trying to do. Blah, 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 blah. We're reading Twitter. Yes.
I just want to double check that there aren't any things that, Okay.
Okay!
Just wanted to make sure there weren't any other questions sneaking in, you know, on my places. Okay, so yeah, I think I've covered just about everything I can think of that I felt was interesting that wasn't just about blah 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 me, I'm so great, how creative and funny am I. So if you have any other questions for the members of Cirque du So What that we could possibly get answers to in a future episode, then please contact the website badreport.com and leave a comment. You could also call 916-LUKESKI and leave a phone message. You could also, I guess those are the two main ways. If you for emails that won't get read on the air, email badreport@gmail.com. And then, of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook. But our main way to get people to ask us things that we answer on the air is comments for this episode at the page itself at badreport.com for episode 15.5. And also for calling in 916-LUKESKI on the Google Voice, which I already took down, so I forgot what the number is. It's 916-LUKESKI.
And email Devo Spice and tell him to update the Cirque du So What website, please.
Okay.
All right, so that is it. I'm going to I was gonna start the show with the Arrogant Worms, and then I was gonna do that, and then I'm gonna play a song by me, and then later in the show, I'm going to play a song by you.
Ooh.
Guess what the topic might be?
If it isn't Tile, I have no idea.
I don't know. It's like I can't find where I am, or something is missing, and island, people, stuff.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so.
Okay.
I'll be right back with talk about a certain television show with Voice of Kiki. Chris Mezzalesta of Power Salad, any final thoughts here on KiCon or Cirque du So What or other things?
Poutine! I want poutine! Okay!
This is your captain. I want to thank you for flying Oceanic Flight 815. Looks like we may have a little turbulence here, so please return to your seats, because it looks like we're heading for a wipeout!
Someone somewhere in the middle of the South Pacific. There's an island whose location is not specific. We're several dozen passengers of Oceanic Flight 815, crash like the Titanic. They are hiding from a smoggy beast that's quite horrific in a bunker with a scientific hieroglyphic. But Ben is saying, come on, babies, don't you panic, cause I'm gonna be your very own satanic mechanic. Dr. Jack will be their leader and will help them all survive. Now he's taking care of much more than a party of five, and he'll get them off the island no matter what the cost. At least that's what he tells himself. But now, just like your luggage, they're lost. Everybody get lost. The other's a cost. While Desmond gets sauce. There's a newborn boy named Aaron, and that baby is Claire's. Now the Aussie kid can play with all the local polar bears who are lost. Now Kate was on the run, could really use a lawyer.
I do run, she do.
She don't know if she loves Jack or loves that con man Sawyer.
Today's not a Sawyer, he can
tie. When they need explosives, I knows just how to bomb it. And poor Charlie never really kicked his heroin hobbit. It appeals to the mundanes, it appeals to the geeks. Like the movie Castaway starring the cat from Twin Peaks. And will Michael be forgiven by the friends he double crossed? His son Walt made it home, but his dog is like the rest of us are lost. Not everybody gets lost. June and son are star-crossed. Cause her dad's a mob boss. There's no Blu-ray discs or iPhones, no, not even an Atari. Just that crazy card from Zoe, who is also a Minbari, who's lost.
Hello, I'm Dr. Marvin Candle. Welcome to this Dharma Initiative drum solo. Your job is to dance the dance of your choice, be it the twist, Watusi, or bad robot. Our psychologist will take notes on you and then pick new contestants for ABC's Dancing with the Stars. Namaste!
Everybody say four!
Four!
Push the button, it'll send you round the bay, and in 108 minutes, we can do it all again!
Yay!
Shamrock had a failed relationship with Peggy Bundy. But on the island, he's a badass crocodile Dundee. He can build a trap of bassinet with no screwdriver. And he'd win $1 million if he was on Survivor. The Hansel Corporation will be working every angle. It's like Lord of the Flies in the Bermuda Triangle. After Hurley won the lottery, his cash was albatross. Now he's chilling on the beach where no one notices the weight he ain't lost.
Everybody get lost. Beds don't holocaust. Dharma bodies were tossed.
The Oceanic Six is in the helmet stall. They're rowing flag to a kid's island in the twilight zone. Is it faith or is it science or coincidence or fate? If it happens to who cares? The ratings will be great. Thanks to that guy, J.J. Abrams, every week the fans will cringe. Is that Monster Cloverfield or are they living on the fringe? Man, I better wrap this up because it's gone on far too long, or I just might flash back to a completely different song and get lost!
This is Luke Ski, and we have now transported magically, almost as if this was some kind of sideways alternate universe, over to almost... finished abode of Voice of Kiki. Say hello, Kiki.
Hello, Kiki.
Yay. She wrote a rather interesting thing and posted it on her live journal. And since I wanted to talk about the finale of Lost, and Carrie doesn't watch Lost, and Carrie and Kiki does, it seemed like I'll hang out with her, have her read this thing, and then she and I can talk about it after she answers a phone call from who? Who's it from?
It is from Cindy, my future roommate.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, Voice of Kiki reading a thing she wrote about the finale of Lost.
What it felt like to watch the Lost finale, a non-spoilery metaphor for non-fans. I thought I'd write this little hypothetical scenario to help those who had never watched Lost understand what it felt like to be a die-hard Lost fan at the ending moments of the finale last night. I know some fans don't agree with me, but I think it will more or less sum up the feelings of the vast majority of posters I've seen online since the finale. As always, it's just what it felt like to me. If you felt differently, I'm glad for you. I'd much rather be you than me right now. So indulge me in this little scenario. Imagine you love murder mysteries. You start reading a book that is touted as the great murder mystery of the ages. You get hooked easily in the first chapter. In the first few pages, the author presents you with a man's corpse. We don't know his identity, but we quickly learn that his life is shrouded in mystery. By the end of the first chapter, the author has presented us with several important questions. Who is this man? Who killed him? Why did they kill him? How did they kill him? You read the second chapter. You're presented with many characters who are somehow connected with the man. You get the idea that one of them, or maybe a group of them, hold all the answers. At the chapter's end, the author repeats the same questions. Who is this man? Who killed him? Why did they kill him? How did they kill him? The third chapter introduces more characters. Soon you begin to think that maybe you care more about the characters than the questions the author has posed, but the author's having none of it. He begins to pepper those questions into the body of the chapters now, and not just at the end. You are relentlessly forced to confront the same questions. Who is this man? Who killed him? Why did they kill him? How did they kill him? In the subsequent chapters, you begin to wonder if the author had the end of the book planned when he started. Events are muddled and characters act strangely. You read an interview with the author in which he assures you that he's known the ending all along. He promises that if you just trust him, you will know the answers to all the questions he has posed. He's been a good writer so far, so you trust him. You go back to pondering the questions. Who is this man? Who killed him? Why did they kill him? How did they kill him? Finally, you near the end of the book. There are a few subplots that begin to be wrapped up and answered. At the end of every paragraph, you are promised by some character or the narrator that soon you will know the answers to all the questions. Who is this man? Who killed him? Why did they kill him? How did they kill him? You have arrived at the end. You hold your breath and turn to the final page. You're about to have all the answers you've been promised for so long. You rest your eyes upon the final page and see a picture of a rabbit with a pancake on its head. You blink with surprise. This wasn't at all what you'd expected. Underneath the picture, you find the last words of the book. They read, "It turns out the answers to those questions weren't that important after all. Instead, enjoy the knowledge that this bunny lives in a happy home and gets plenty of carrots every day." Now imagine it took you 6 years to read that book. And, just for argument's sake, imagine that when you first started reading the book, a bunch of people had posted online saying, "I bet they never answer anything, and at the end we just get a picture of a bunny." The author didn't take that well and responded in many interviews saying, "I can assure you that we'll answer everything, and there will definitely not be a picture of a bunny at the end." After you read the final chapter, you send the author an email saying, "But I thought that they were wrong about the bunny picture." The author replies, "Well, technically that's true. They didn't say it would be a picture of a bunny with a pancake on its head." You sit and stare at the closed book and wonder how to feel about this. You might have liked the bunny ending if only the author hadn't persisted with those damn questions. You liked most of the book. It was a fun read and full of good characters. But when you view the story as a whole, you can't help but feel cheated and lied to by the author. So there you have it, guys. Now you know what it's like to be a Lost fan today.
I enjoy bunnies and pancakes!
No, thank you very much, Kiki. That was very awesome, and pretty accurate, I'd have to say. It's like, it literally took me a few days, let me think. It aired Sunday, Tuesday, yeah, like maybe a couple of days of pondering. And then I visited my best friend Steph in Madison on our way back through, because I bought her some ketchup-flavored potato chips and had to deliver them to her, plus I wanted to see my kitty cats. I talked with her briefly, and then after she said some things to me, it, like, things started to click as to what everything meant. Because me and Shoebox watched it live together on CTV in Canada, and I was kind of confused about what it all meant and what happened when. So basically, this is the way I'm understanding the finale of Lost is, and the explanation for the sixth season and, you know, by extension, the entire series, was that the bomb that went off at the end of season 5 was, like, that basically it didn't actually go off at all. And that was kind of, I guess, is I don't know if this is the correct literary term, that was just a red herring to throw everybody off when they started season 6 and we started seeing all of the supposed, you know, as many people have been called them, the Flash sideways universes
because we kind of were viewing it all like, oh, this is the parallel alternate reality where the plane didn't land. So we were seeing the characters' lives in the year 2004, just after, yeah, 2004, you know, just after Oceanic 815 landed safely and everything was fine. You know, they still lost his father's body, you know, in transit, Jack's father's body in transit, but otherwise we got to see, like, oh, well, if this hadn't existed, this and that would have happened, and there would be different people, and Jack has a son, and, Locke was in a wheelchair, but it was for a different reason, and he actually knew his father, and they got along, and he was with Katie Sagal, and, you know, so it's like, we were all waiting all season to find out what that all meant, you know, and how the Flash sideways universe that we kind of viewed it as happening parallel to what was happening back on the island where the bomb supposedly didn't go off. And then the end, we find out that all of the Flash sidewayses was not actually flashing sidewayses, that was meant to be like limbo, you know, between heaven and earth. I don't know if it was necessarily purgatory. Limbo might be a bit more accurate, where basically it was this perceived reality by the entire group, like a mass, you know, post corporeal life delusion in which everyone could find each other again and then all be like prepared to make the next steps into heaven, and that the island was real and all that shit did happen, and that, you know, the Flash sideways were just like, whenever each of these individual people actually ended up dying, they or their souls or whatever went to the, you know, limbo land, where in that existence the plane never crashed and they got to live a bit of their lives and, you know, things were generally happy, and somehow Desmond was the linchpin that, you know, figured it all out and, like, tipped everyone off so that they could all meet at that church and then go la-la happily into heaven. So that basically the part of the show that was, like, for lack of a better term, you know, television cliche of, oh, it was all a dream and now they're dead and go to heaven, that the part where they're dead and they went to heaven was just the Flash sideways of season 6 and not the entire series. So that basically the first 5 years plus the first 5 years all really happened, and the stuff that happened on the island during season 6 really happened, but all the Flash sideways happened in like weird limbo pre-heaven, you know, territory.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of what I was, you know, a lot of people are pulling up all these videos and interviews with J.J. Abrams and Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof, where they said for 6 years, because the first major theory that caught on with the fans back in season one, beginning of season two, was they all actually died in the plane crash, and this island is some sort of test or purgatory or limbo or final delusion that, you know, and then we'll know after these trials who's worthy to go to heaven or go to hell or whatever. And so it was kind of, that was kind of my point with the, like, well, you forgot about the pancake on the bunny's head. It's like, okay, technically they weren't lying when they said, no, they didn't die in the plane crash, and it's reality, and they're not in purgatory, because at that point, they weren't. But in a way, it felt kind of cheating, because it was the only theory that they ever bothered to specifically deny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all 6 years, the only theory they ever specifically felt like coming forward and denying was the idea of it's purgatory and they're all dead. And then to use it and kind of be like, well, technically that was true, because it was only in the other universe that we saw that they were dead. I got very upset, because it began to make me wonder if that wasn't the plan all along, and then they got really pissed off that fans caught on too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tried to rewrite it to throw the fans off track, because they were upset that, like, oh, no, they caught on too much. So instead of just keeping their mouth shut and letting it go ahead and be the metaphor that they wanted it to be or whatever, and then at the end have a bunch of fans go, oh, wow, aren't we smart because we figured it out in the first season, so we're the bestest fans ever. You know, mm-hmm. if they'd have just kept their mouth shut, it would have been a perfectly okay ending. I mean, some people would have been pissed off because some people are going to be pissed off no matter what you do.
Yeah.
But I think the vast majority of fans would have been able to just be like, okay, all the flashbacks or whatever were their real lives. And, oh, I mean, it wouldn't have, you know, once they started with the flash forwards and everything, if it had stayed the same, I guess, that would have been different. Yeah. But
well, I mean, I'm very, at least, well, at least to my interpretation of it after I talked with Steph, it's like, I was very happy to figure out. Because the thing that confused me at first was I thought they meant that the entire six seasons was, you know, they were all dead before the show even started, you know, delusion, and so that basically nothing actually mattered, and it was like, you know, Dallas, it was just a dream. Good night, everybody. You know, but then, you know, and that's what was making me think, like, no, like, I'm missing something. I'm kind of missing a connection. And then I talked to Steph, and I'm like, oh, okay, if that's what they meant by it, and it was just, you know, the B track of season six, you know, that, you know, then it's kind of like, all right, well, I guess I can accept that then, because, you know, I wanted this all to be taking place in real reality and not in, you know, so like, okay, so, so basically, I guess my point is that I can accept it, and if my interpretation of it is what the general interpretation of it is by most people, then I can deal with it. I mean, it's certainly not, it is not the best series finale ever. It's not the worst series finale ever. It certainly is better than Seinfeld. Seinfeld was probably about the worst series finale ever.
Yeah.
And it was probably, better than the series finale of Battlestar. Because, I mean, you know.
Well, at least on, somebody asked me about this afterwards online about whether or not I thought Battlestar or Lost won the series finale war. And in many ways, I kind of want to give it to Battlestar, because at least Battlestar attempted to answer a few of the questions they asked. Like, that's my biggest beef. Like, I could have accepted that ending if in the, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes before they started on that ending, they'd have answered one single fucking question they'd ever given.
Okay, so here's which of these two questions is the bigger disappointment not having answered? What the fuck was up with Starbuck versus what the fuck was up with Walt? Because to me, what the fuck was up with Starbuck is a bigger disappointment, because, you know, I was expecting her to be the last Cylon, the, you know, Cylon number 7 that we never found out who or what the fuck that was. For them to, like, you know, to just try to be like, well, she's, you know, she's a magical angel. Goodbye! You know, and, you know, so, I mean, to me, because she was such an important main, she was pretty much the, you know, next to, like, who, Adama and Apollo, she's, you know, pretty much the main character of the show. You know.
Yeah, but at least they did basically, like, you know, you got the idea of, like, okay, there is a god or a group of gods. Like, Battlestar was always kind of upfront about that. Like, there is a very mystical force, and there are these, you know, there's at least one kind of ineffable deity out there that's messing with things and setting things in motion. Lost tried to be so all-encompassing. You know, it tried to get, you know, Christian ideas and Buddhist ideas and Hindu ideas and Egyptian mythology and pretty much everything. And so I think that because they tried to be so broad, they kind of invalidated all of their kind of religious points by trying to make it so all-encompassing. But it's like, at least on Battlestar, you know, I said it this way to my friend, at least on Battlestar they answered, what is Earth? I mean, at least we got to Earth and we got to see what it was and why it was important. And granted, it was a big difference than what we thought it was. You know, we thought they were just going to show up and land on our planet, and it wasn't what that was, which was a great twist. But at least they bothered to answer that question. You know, that was a huge question that had been, like, from the beginning of the series. Like, there's this mythical planet. We will go find it. And that's great. And it's like, they gave all these metaphors for what the island was, and that's all kind of cool. It's a cork, and it's a prison, and it's whatever you want to call it. But they never gave one definitive answer. They gave all these kind of interpretations through various characters. They never gave you, like, a clear idea on who was right about it. But it was, you know, it was more, I get mad at the questions that the show explicitly asked us versus what the fans came up with. I read a review that said, you know, where the writers were saying, like, well, it's maybe not better if we answer all the questions because it might end up being like when you found out that midichlorians were what caused the Force.
Yeah.
And a blogger on IO9 read that and said, yeah, but here's the problem with that. One, we already knew what the Force was. Like, Obi-Wan gives a perfectly good explanation in the first movie. It's an energy field that is created by all life. That's a good enough explanation. You really don't need to know more than that. But the other thing is, Star Wars didn't stop every 5 minutes to ask you, what is the Force?
Ooh.
Whereas Lost, for 6 years, pretty much every commercial for Lost ended with Charlie going, guys, where are we? What is this island? Mm-hmm. You know, and it was the overwhelming thing. And, you know, they tried to explain the numbers in the end by being like, they were, you know, a lot of people...
They were the numbers on, like, that 360-degree... you know, magical lighthouse thing.
Or the ones that were on the rock or whatever that corresponded. But the thing is that there are, you know, was it just coincidental that they were there? You know, they seemed to have some power beyond that, and that was more like just another occurrence. To me, it's just as wrong to say, like, oh, well, those were just there, but the answer for the numbers is that they corresponded to the candidates. I think that's just as wrong as it would be saying, like, well, the numbers are important because that's how Hurley won the lottery. Yeah. It's just another instance of them showing up to me rather than being the final explanation for all of it.
And it's like, what was I going to say? I just got distracted because my phone made a noise.
The phone is derailing.
All right, so basically, like I already mentioned, like to my mind, the biggest unanswered question was Walt.
I was very upset about that too.
Because they made a big deal about it. They did whole episodes, you know, the whole thing with Walt getting kidnapped and then Michael betraying everyone so that he and his son could get home. I mean, it was nice that Walt got home. He's one of the few people that really got off the island and seemed to get back to a normal life without any consequences, you know. But it's just kind of like, well, what was the point of all that? Why, you know, was Walt a candidate? Was that why he was important? You know, they could have panned across and seen, you know, inside the cave, you know, Walt with his name with a line through it, and it would have been like, oh, that's why he was important, you know, if nothing else, you know, and they just kind of left it standing there. Even when Locke went to visit him, which season was it? Was that this season or the previous season?
That was last season.
Yeah, so even when Locke went to visit him, something could have happened. I don't know. Anyway. But what else things weren't answered that you considered to be, you know...
Why couldn't women get pregnant or carry babies to term? That was a huge one because they asked that all the time. That was big through, like, the first 4 seasons and then it was just kind of forgotten about. And I saw somebody in there, I've been reading a lot of reviews online about how people interpret the finale, and I read someone saying, like, oh, well, that really didn't need to be answered because it wasn't, you know, once Sun left the island and had her baby off the island, that wasn't really important anymore because it didn't directly affect, but yeah, it kind of did, you know, I mean, it's like, why was Charlie fated to die? You know, they made such a huge deal about that. Like, Charlie was always going to come to a bad end, but why? I mean, why couldn't he have been a candidate like any of the rest of them? What disqualified him from that? You know, what...
And something that I don't think anyone else has brought up is just the fact that we're talking about a show that concentrated on, like, 20 survivors mainly, and there were more than 20 survivors on that plane. And for many seasons, they were always milling about in the background here and that. And then, like, during one series of oh, we're being attacked by this and that and the other, run for your lives, and then you see people getting, you know, flaming spears through them, and then suddenly all those background extras who are on the plane who survived were all dead, and they don't matter anymore. Now it's just the main people. It was just kind of a weird clean sweep of like, okay, all these other background people are just fucking scenery, they don't matter, and now let's get to this. So it's just kind of
weird. And
they
did it too with Ajira. Yeah. With the Ajira flight, when they came back to the island, and there were all these people that survived the Ajira flight that were there with Lapidus and Son and all them, you know, when they landed, kind of.
And then basically, wasn't it like Whittemore's people?
Yeah, and then
them all?
Yeah, then they show up, and it's like they're all dead in a pile, and it's like, oh, Whittemore's people are here now. And it made just as much sense as...
And Whittemore somehow could magically, I mean, maybe he had a tracking device on the plane hidden or something, I don't know.
Yeah, and they never explained, like, what was up with Whittemore. And what... Okay, if you're going to say that there's a mystical light at the center of an island that's really important, tell us why. Like, some people have theorized that it was, like, the soul, like, basically the soul of the entire world, and so all goodness went away if that light went out. And if so, then tell us that's what it was, or at least show us. They did, I felt during the sixth season that unless it was the really big mythology episodes, which I know a lot of people didn't like, I loved it. Like, all the stuff where you find out that the...
Like, if that whole episode with Jacob and the Man in Black and their mother and their origin, and like, if that episode hadn't happened, that would be, like, the hugest fucking bitch ball right now. Like, what was up with Jacob and them? It's like, they didn't answer it. It's like, well, they did answer it. And now some people are like, that was a bunch of bullshit. It's like, you're going to complain no matter what the fuck we do.
Yeah, well, it's... And I think they did a good job at answering part of it. But at the end of that episode, it was almost like they teased, okay, in two more episodes, you're going to tell everything. And it was... You know, that I think the problem that I have most of all is I would not have had such a problem with the ending if the creators hadn't lied to us for 6 years. You know, it's not going to be about purgatory. We will answer all the questions that we have posed. That was another big one. And the last big one was early on, the writers had said, you know, not only is there an explanation for everything that goes on the island, It's a scientific explanation. We're not making fantasy voodoo stuff. Which at the end, it pretty much ended up being fantasy, religious, voodoo, whatever. I mean, it's there's a light, and there's a stone in a hole, and if you take the stone out of the hole, the island sinks, and supposedly that's a bad thing, but we don't really get told why it's a bad thing. I mean, if they'd have just had... It would have been better if they would have had what a lot of people theorized that the Sideways universe was, which was to tell us what would happen if he got off the island, you know? And if it had been like, oh, everybody on it was evil or there wasn't love in the world, which is what it seemed to be at first. Like, it seemed to be that, okay, some things happen, but you're not with the people you really love. You know, so you've never experienced true love, which could be considered a very bad and soul-crushing thing. Some people claimed that it was supposed to be them getting the happy ending that they needed for everything they suffered on the island, but I didn't ever see how that was a happier ending. You know, just a lot of people were saying, like, this is much better than what they went through on the island, and I kept thinking, well, no, because to me it's like I'd rather have a character die having done something important or going through a struggle than just still be alive somewhere. Like, to me, just being alive doesn't equal happy ending. So...
Here's the thing I thought. I didn't bother to follow through and read the articles, but I saw, you know, headlines anyway, you know, talking to cast members, and they, you know, this was before the finale happened, you know, they're saying why there will never be a Lost movie or a continuation of any kind. And I was thinking, all right, Walt got off the island. Aaron got off the island, and I forgot the kid's name, but...
Gion.
Jin and Sun's daughter is safe on the island. Wouldn't it be cool if, like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, there was, like, the Children of Lost, and they did something with it, you know, way in the future. I mean, I don't know. That's just kind of... Somewhere in my brain is a Hollywood executive who thinks of ideas that other people would consider to be horrible, you know? Like, oh, God, why can't you just let it go? Why do you have to, you know, make a million sequels? God, you're stupid.
Yeah,
you
well,
know, but my brain just thinks that way sometimes. It's like, well, it'd be cool to see, you know, at the very least, like a made-for-TV movie, like what happened to Walt, Aaron, and Gian or whatever, you know?
And the thing, there was... I'm not even sure I would want to watch a sequel anymore because I don't trust those writers.
Yeah.
And somebody, you know, in response to the thing I read, said something about, you know, oh, people are always upset when they don't like what happens on TV shows, but these writers don't owe you anything. And I always hate when people are like, you know, the only person they owe is their own creativity. No, that's not true. If you're writing, you know, a diary or something that you're just going to read, mm-hmm. then yes, that's all you owe. But it's like, I'm a...
Emily and the Really Sexy Vampire.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you're writing Emily and the Really Sexy Vampire just because, you know, you want to have this story to read and you don't really care, you know, what happens to... But it's like... And in the first season, they might have just written this pilot because it was something they thought was interesting, and if it got picked up, then great, and if it didn't, then oh well. But, you know, at least by season three, you know you've got people hanging on your every word.
Yeah.
And you have promised them a certain thing, which is that they will... You know, it's you don't even have to like... the ending, but at the very least, give us what you promised us. If you're the one like hitting us over the head with questions and mysteries, then you've got to be the one to solve it, or you've got to give us a really good reason why those questions shouldn't be answered.
It's like Dan Harmon, who created the TV show Community and Channel 101, did a bunch of badass stuff with Rob Schraub, who created Scud. They did a spinoff series from Scud called La Cosa Nostra, which was basically Goodfellas meets Voltron. And, you know,
cool. That's
a bit, I mean, and it's a very silly premise, but they took it seriously, like, we're doing a real mafia drama here set in the cyber future. And I forgot how many issues into the series they were, but one of the characters, one of my favorite characters, got killed off. Like, Tony, the main character, you know, killed him. Tony Tasty killed this one character off, and I was, like, shocked. I'm like, what, you know, A, why the fuck did that happen? You know, why did that have to happen? That was bullshit. And I was like, what the hell is up with Dan? And then it was like, I read in a future issue he had like written up some kind of, you know, note from the editor thing that they do in most comics. And, you know, it was just something about, you know, the overall gist of it was, you know, in good stories, you know, bad things have to happen for it to be interesting. And it kind of made me realize that when it came to writing, as far as trying to write things that are stories and narratives, I don't know if I'd really be a good writer, because when I create characters I like, I don't want to have bad things happen to them. You know, so it's like that notion of I'm watching a show and then somebody I like gets killed, and it's like, that really sucks, that's a bunch of bullshit. And it's like, you know, kind of like the whole Joss Whedon thing. It's like, you know, what would have happened in Buffy if, you know, insert character name here, hadn't died? Like, if nobody had ever died, the cast would be so full by the end of the series, is they'd be like, you know, there's too much shit to do, there's too many plot lines, you know, it's like, so, you know, it's just like, looking at Lost, it's like, well, and Lost, I have to admit, though, Lost is one of the few TV series where, if your character died in season two, that doesn't necessarily mean you're off the show.
Yeah.
I mean, through either flashbacks or magic or mystery, you will show up later on in the show. Like the fucking teacher dude, I loved him. Every time I saw him on screen again, like, I'm the fucking teacher dude!
Yeah.
He was fucking awesome, so I loved seeing him pop up here and there. So, yeah.
To me, when you're talking about, you know, bad things happening and character deaths, it's like, my biggest pet peeve is doing it for just the sake of, like...
Shock value?
Yeah, shock value or thinking you've created drama, which I think is what Joss does a lot of times. And it's like, to me...
It's like that, oh, we have to kill off somebody because nobody is safe, And so that you'll be, like, biting your nails through every episode.
That's not the way to create tension. In fact, that's, you know, and when I watched Dollhouse, I it was my first one after I'd kind of accepted that facet of Joss Whedon where I'm like, he just does this because he thinks it's going to create tension. And there were certain characters in the first episode where I looked at my father who was watching it with me and who is not a Joss Whedon fan, and I would just point out characters as soon as they walked on the screen and be like, they're dead by the end of the series, they're dead by the end of the series, that person's dead by the end of the series. And to a person, I was correct. Some of them it took till the final minutes of the final episode to die, but it's like every single person I called was dead by the end of the season because Joss was like, oh, people like this character, and if they die, it's going to be emotional. And because of that reason, I never really got into that show on an emotional level. There has to be something else.
The fact that Topher made it to the last episode was like, oh my god, my favorite character didn't die until the last episode.
But I think that was only by default of that was their, you know, just didn't have time to finish whatever he was going to do.
Yeah.
Like, he had to wrap it up. I think Topher would have died at the end of season two.
Did you watch Angel when it was actually on the air?
I watched the final season. I didn't watch before that.
Yeah, because, like, Joss basically found out, he had, like, laid out all these story arcs and then found out he was getting canceled. So he had to, like, wrap up, like, multiple story arcs within six episodes. It was, like, kind of like Whedon on fast forward. It was so trippy.
Yeah, and I do remember watching that and knowing that that was the reason. But it's like, I mean, going back to Lost, it's like, if a character dies, they were usually good about it there being, like, one or reason. I'm big about they have to die for a reason. Not necessarily that they have to die for, you know, as a hero, but there has to be some reason for them to die other than we wanted to shock you or make you feel like this was dramatic. So if it's, you know... And it has to be a part of some other character's story arc. Like, they have to change either because of the death or because they caused the death or, you know... Libby and Anna Lucia dying was great in Michael's story arc because it defined everything he did after that.
Yeah.
You know, and it defined Hurley losing Libby, and it defined a lot of people like that. And so it was, one, it was shocking because you didn't expect them both to die quite like that.
Mm-hmm.
But two, it was also really good because there were, you know, impact from the grief and the guilt that it caused other characters was still being felt later on in the series. You know, you find out that Michael can't, his spirit can't leave the island because of his guilt and all that kind of stuff. And that was great storytelling. That was a good reason. But it's, you know, Charlie sacrificing himself to save Desmond and get the warning out was a great death because it made sense. And it, you know, Claire had stuff after that, and Desmond had stuff after that. Everybody missed Charlie, and it was... That, I thought, was good writing. And that's the problem I have, like, thinking back on Lost, and it's because for 5 years, or for almost 6 years, it was great writing. And then it was, you know, it was like 6 years minus the final episode, really. And somebody, I read a review again on IO9 where a blogger was saying that that a lot of people have said, like, oh, the last 15 minutes of Lost sucked. And she was like, no, the last 2.5 hours of Lost sucked because the characters were acting very strangely. If you really look back, you felt at the end that the characters were more serving the plot than, you know, being driven by what used to drive them. And in the Sideways universe, all the internal logic of this world they had been living in just kind of stopped just to get everybody together at the party. You know, and it was like, maybe I missed it, but when did Boone get his little island awakening in the Sideways world? All of a sudden he's just there with Hurley and he's like, oh, yay, it's a good thing that we got Shannon and Saeed back together. You know, and
yeah,
it was like,
I mean,
when did they find Boone and get him to do...
I think they just like riffed it off in dialogue as if to imply, oh, Hurley went and found them and set this up in advance to make it more of a surprise for us, the viewer, like, oh, shit, look, there's Boone, there's Shannon, you know.
Yeah, and so, the other thing is if you're supposed to be, like, coming into contact with your true love or whatever. Shannon is Saeed's true love? Really? Like, the vapid blonde chick that he knew for 3 weeks and only seemed to care about for 2 days of that?
Yeah.
It's not Nadia, the woman that he, like, killed people trying to find?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because in the Sideways universe, Nadia was actually, like, what, married to his brother and living in a house somewhere?
Yeah.
Remember? Yeah, so it was like, I don't know.
But the Sideways universe doesn't matter because everything has been, you know.
So, okay, I should probably wrap this up because I don't want to get the thing to be too long. I just want to, like, let's recap. Who, in the reality that was reality, okay, people who got off the island in the last episode were Kate and Sawyer.
Miles.
Miles, Lapidus, and Alpert.
Yes.
They were on the plane, right?
Yes.
Okay, people who stayed on the island were, you know, Jack, even though he, like, died,
yeah,
you know, very shortly after. Hurley, Linus, and Desmond.
And Rose and Bernard.
Rose and Bernard and Vincent the dog.
Yes.
So, okay. So everyone else either died or got off the island before that.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And really the only people who got off the island and then never went back were Walt and Aaron and Ji-Yun or whatever the daughter. So it's like the kids got off and the people on that plane got off. And the thing is that, you know, it's good to know that Hurley was a great leader of the island, and it's good to know that we got, but I wasn't really caring by that point because I kept expecting the big revelation I was promised. And at the end of it, they did more kind of telling than showing, which is supposed to be the thing you never want to do when you're writing. You know, it's
yeah,
like we were told that a bad thing would happen, but we could have gotten 30 seconds of seeing people on the mainland losing their souls or whatever when the light went out, if that was it.
And I just realized probably the entire point of Bernard and Rose making that little house and being like, oh, we're just here, we decided we're living here, blah, 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 we're not being involved. The entire point of that was for the final shot of Jack laying on the ground so that Vincent would walk up.
Yeah.
That was the whole point of that, was so they could justify why Vincent suddenly appeared again to match up with the opening shot. You know,
yeah,
and that's fine, you know, because, you know, Bernard and Rose was, you know, I liked them. I think they deserved a happy ending where it's like, all right, fuck it, we're not going back. We're going to live here on this island because on this island, Rose's cancer won't kill her. And, yeah.
Yeah,
so.
And I mean, they had a good reason to stay. Like, I didn't feel that that was so much contrived because they'd set it up early about her cancer and her not wanting to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the things that upset people most was that it felt contrived because the Sideways universe was completely invalidated after that. We'd put time and effort into figuring it out, and then it was just fake and nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I think people were upset about was apparently black people only get into heaven if they've married white people. Because Rose was the only one in that church.
Oh,
it was like, of the minorities, Rose and Saeed were it. Like, and Walt wasn't there, Michael wasn't there, Mr. Echo wasn't there.
You don't know when that scene takes place in the arc of reality because, well, then again, the baby was there.
Yeah, the babies were there. It's, you know, it's
So Walt wasn't there and Jun and Sin's, do I have that right?
Yeah, Jin and Sun's kid was there, Aaron was there. Oh, well, the baby hadn't been born yet, but it was still there, because
Son
was pregnant. Yeah, so.
So, I don't know. So we're going to leave our wrap-up with the final conclusion being, fuck it all, we don't know, which is basically the same way they ended their series. So.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for listening. This has been Bad Rapport. I'm Luke, and
I'm Kiki.
And we will talk to you all sometime soon. Peace.
Lost on ABC is a show that never made much sense to me. I spent hours trying to figure what it meant, what the island represents, the writer's main intent. Play my DVR instead and search for reasons why the polar bear is there. Why the statue only has four freaking toes? Perhaps nobody knows. If that's the case, it blows. But I'll be lost without my lost. Despite the hours of my life, the program cost. Try to make some sense of Jack. His tattoos, the oceanic crew, generic Dharma brew. I'm hoping that I'm wrong. They make it all up as they go along.
It was all a dream, dreamt up by Hurley Volkswagen Van.
Okay, the lighthouse was built by time-traveling Norwegians who had studied the theories of Ludwig von Drake.
The alternate reality that was created when Juliet set off the bomb presents each character in a state not unlike.
It seems obvious that the island is a metaphor for man's struggles against the forces of evil, and once we understand...
Jacob is good, except when he's evil. Except when...
But I'll be lost without my lost. It's like a cliffside cave where all the names are crossed. Without the show, I'll be like Claire without her kid. A hatch without a lid. John Locke without Saeed. When they finally do explain, I still will go on blocks and complain.
Listening to Luke and Carrie's Bad Rapport.
Refill the flagon of chuckles.
Leave comments for this episode at badrapport.com or call 916-LUKE-SKI.